through the year. Have a good Christmas and a safe New Year.
Thanks so much, Nick, and a Merry Christmas to you as well. Donald Trump has decided to name a new fleet of warships after himself. It even has his face on the aft of the ship, as it were. Is anyone surprised? This is only the latest move in Trump 2, which has made America seem, well, a little more banana republic than American republic than ever before. The renaming of the Kennedy Center, the Trump Kennedy Center. He's made $800 million from crypto in 6 months while being in charge of crypto. He's proposed seizing Gaza to build a Trump-branded beach resort. He's demolished the White House to build a gold ballroom. He blamed DEI for a helicopter crash. And he called Somali Americans garbage. Is this chaos as we've known before, or is it kleptocracy with a presidential seal of approval? Is Trump madder than ever?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, police leaders are understood to be pushing for the Home Secretary to scrap non-crime hate incidents in the new year. Officials will meet with Shabana Mahmood next month and call for a new common-sense approach instead. Under the plans, officers will reportedly only record the most serious antisocial behaviour offences. His Majesty's Chief Inspector of Constabulary, Sir Andy Cook, told LBC in September that the system needs to be reviewed.
Police are struggling to understand it. The public certainly don't understand it. So the legislation, in my view, and the policy around it needs to change. People do want to see police officers on the streets. I mean, my annual report is very clear that the police need to focus on the issues that the public see as the real problems, the street crimes, the lawlessness, the lack of visible police presence on the streets. And the police need to get the basics right around this.
A man is due to appear in court in Swindon, charged with 56 offences against his former wife. Philip Young, who's 49, is accused of drugging and raping Joanne Young over a 13-year period. Five other men have also been charged with sexual offences against the 48-year-old, who's waived her right to anonymity. Officials in Ukraine say there are widespread power cuts across the country after Russia launched a massive air attack overnight. One person was killed in Kyiv, while two others were killed in the west of the country. The family of a police officer injured during the Bondi Beach shooting say he's woken up from a medically induced coma. Scott Dyson was one of two officers hurt during the attack, in which 15 people were killed. The local government secretary has warned councils in England not to introduce a four-day working week. It's after the system was brought in by the South Cambridgeshire District Council earlier this year. A Labour source says voters deserve high standards and seeing staff working a four-day week won't cut it. But the Lib Dem councillor Bridget Smith, who leads the South Cambridgeshire Authority, told LBC in July that it's massively improved productivity.
It's taken us from being a good council to being an outstanding council because our staff are highly motivated. They are working much, much smarter. We've seen improvements across the board. We've saved nearly £400,000 a year because we're not paying expensive agency staff.
And people who've grown up in care will be able to get free prescriptions and dental treatments until their 25th birthday. The government has announced plans to extend support for around 100,000 more young people from next year. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 10 at 98.76. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.14. LBC weather, cloudy for large parts of the UK today. Some outbreaks of rain in the west with a high of 10 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 10:04. You're listening to Lewis Goodall here on LBC, sitting in for James O'Brien, up to and including Christmas Eve. Don't let it be said that Santa isn't treating you this year. Lots of politics to get through. And of course, as we approach the big day, of course, on the 25th, it is natural in news terms as well to just take a little bit of a breather and think about the year just gone. And the year just gone has been characterised by one thing and one man. The restoration, the return of the daily drumbeat of all of our lives, the daily punctuation of Trump. Day after day, week after week, he lives inside our heads. We cannot escape him. He is on every screen. He is on virtually every tweet. He is on every platform. He is inescapable. He is ubiquitous. It is the key to his success. In so many ways, he is a communications genius, the social media president, the first thereof after a string of television presidents. He understands the content age in which we live. It is one of the reasons, one of the many reasons, he is a more successful politician than someone like Keir Starmer, who would have been far more at home in the late or early 21st centuries. Trump, for better or ill, is a politician of the spirit of our age. And yet, partly as a result of that, partly because he just sits inside our heads, partly because he doesn't leave us alone, partly because he has mastered the art of political and mental, almost physiological exhaustion, it can be so easy to forget what he does and the things that he does and when he does it and what it all amounts to. And you can just become weary with it, which is, as I say, the secret, I think, of his political success. But when you take the long view of the course of his second term, I think this has been something of an entirely different order than we saw in Trump 1. Trump 2 is madder, he's radicalized, and he's more authoritarian. And that has huge implications for the United States and for the world. And I think in this hour of the show, it is just at the end of the year worth thinking about the consequences of those things and taking stock about him, what he's done, how he's did it, and asking you whether you think that Trump's term has been even more bonkers, even madder than you thought it would be. Or maybe you think, actually, he's done some good things and he has got some successes under his belt, which we'll talk about as well. 0345 60 60 973. Let's just review a little bit. Trump's first term was chaos. This term, as I say, madder, more radicalized, more authoritarian, and he's getting rich while he's doing it. He is taking America into full-on banana republic territory at times. What did we learn overnight? He has renamed a whole suite of new American warships after, you guessed it, himself. Because nothing speaks for full-on narcissism than a desire to see a fleet of American warships with your own fat, beaming face off the side. That is the model that he unveiled yesterday. That comes only a week after the renaming of the Kennedy Arts Center in Washington, D.C., a very august institution, been named after President Kennedy for decades, the Trump Kennedy Arts Center. And they had the gall to congratulate President Kennedy, who has been dead since 1963, for the privilege of it. Not often you usually congratulate people who have been dead for the best part of 60 years. But this is Trump's America. Let's look at the money. $800 million in crypto for the Trump estate in 6 months. $11 billion in holdings. Whilst who is regulating crypto? Well, it's Donald Trump. Companies donate to his inauguration. The investigations into those companies disappear. It's not corruption. It's a Trump subscription service. The madness. He posted AI videos of Trump Gaza, luxury resorts with a golden statue of himself. Then actually proposed seizing Gaza, displacing 2 million Palestinians for, you guessed it, Trump hotels. Ethnic cleansing as a business plan. The Riviera of the Middle East. He demolished the White House East Wing overnight. No vote. Just bulldozed it. All for a gold ballroom. He had a Saudi Arabian leader in the Oval Office, and I swear to God, he was looking around the Oval Office, and the Saudi Arabian was probably saying to himself, Jesus, Don, you've gone a bit overboard here with the gold. He's named warship after himself, the USS Trump. He's blamed DEI for a helicopter crash. Charlie Kirk got assassinated and Trump's eulogy became a campaign rally. He called Somalian Americans garbage. He told the Zutu that nobody's ever heard of them. He threatened Rob Reiner with investigation for criticism. When Zelensky came in to discuss Ukraine, Trump pitched him crypto. It goes on, it goes on, and it goes on. And scholars will say, looking at the US under Trump in Trump 2, as opposed to Trump 1, when the guy just didn't really know what he was doing, it reminds you of something. It reminds you of Hungary. It reminds you of India. It reminds you of Turkey. Personal enrichment, attacking judges, purging opposition, purging academic institutions, seizing assets, even deporting his own citizens and refusing to recover them. Seizing Venezuelan oil tankers, bombing Venezuela without any legal authority to do so whatsoever. The first term was about testing limits. The second term has been smashing through them in every single direction. This is increasingly a banana republic where the guy in charge has his own Truth Social account. Just let's go through some of the things that we've seen through the course of this year, just to remind ourselves of the extraordinary headspin that has been Trump 2. Perhaps the absolute nadir to start with. In the Oval Office, with Zelensky and Trump, Donald Trump and J.D. Vance invite the leader of a nation which has been invaded to berate him for the whole world to see.
You're saying that if you will speak very loudly about the war, you
He's not speaking loudly. Your country's in big trouble.
Wait a minute.
Your country is in big trouble.
I know.
You're not winning. You're not winning this. You have a damn good chance of coming out okay because of us.
Mr. President, we are staying in our country, staying strong from the very beginning of the war. We've been alone, and we are thankful. I said thanks in this cabinet, and not only in this cabinet.
We gave you, through this stupid president, $350 billion.
You voted for your president.
We gave you military equipment, and your men are brave, but they had to use our military equipment. If you didn't have our military equipment, this war would have been over in 2 weeks.
In three days. I heard it from Putin. In 3 days. This is something
maybe less.
In 2 weeks. Of course, yes.
It's going to be a very hard thing to do business like this.
Again, I tell you. Just say thank you.
American people.
That summed up a lot of where Trump has taken the United States under his presidency. American presidents, yeah, they always had hard power, but they always knew the value of American values. They didn't insist that allies had to bend the knee in public. They didn't insist that you had to show fealty at the court of the leader. Donald Trump does, because that's the sort of power that he respects. The weak must suffer what they must. And then if you add on to that, never mind the geopolitical stuff, which we can talk more about, because I don't think in Europe we've really woken up to the transformation that has taken place at the heart of American foreign policy. Just think about the little moments that with any other president would have dominated the news cycle for day after day, would probably have imperiled their political authority. Think how often we spoke about Joe Biden's infirmity, rightly so. And yet sometimes we have a man from the Oval Office speaking from the White House podium who frankly sounds completely deranged, perhaps because he is. Remember the tragic helicopter. Well, remember the crash that we saw with the various different planes and so on, the helicopter crash that we saw towards the start of the year. Did Donald Trump blame American policy in this matter or for retrenchment in the federal government without any investigation whatsoever? What did he decide? Who did he decide was to blame? It was DEI.
Targeted disabilities are those disabilities that the federal government, as a matter of policy, has identified for special emphasis in recruitment and hiring. The FAA's website states they include hearing, vision, missing extremities, partial paralysis, complete paralysis, epilepsy, severe intellectual disability, psychiatric disability, and dwarfism all qualify for the position of a controller of airplanes.
And then there is the radicalization that we're seeing in every direction, something we can talk a little bit more about, which is that under Trump 1, Trump was uncertain, unsure of what to do in terms of how far he could push the boundaries of acceptable debate. This time, he and his movement, principally, are completely unleashed. One of the most revealing moments only a couple of weeks ago. You might remember that back in Trump 1, he was accused of describing various countries, including Somalia, in private, as an S-hole country. Why do we take so many people from S-hole countries? Why can't we just have more people from Norway or from Sweden and so on? I wonder why he identifies those countries. And yet the other day, at the time he denied all of that because he said, no, I'm the least racist person you've ever interviewed, he said. Yet the other day when he was at a rally, he openly said it. He openly used those exact words. What had created a complete furore back in 2018, I think it was, barely even created a murmur in the media environment today because it was all received wisdom. He talks of a Somali-American congresswoman as garbage and repeatedly says that she should be deported. J.D. Vance, in exactly that vein the other day, in a hilarious way, referred to Minneapolis as Mogadishu. Oh, Freudian slip, lol. Talking about a local politician there as a Somalian who should go back to his home. He was in fact born in Washington, D.C. This crass racism, xenophobia, bigotry has been normalized to an extent that I think only a year or two, a few years ago, would have made our eyes water. And then in that vein as well, we don't just see it in racism, we see it in all sorts of ways. Sexism, for example. Just the other day, or in November, President Trump telling a Bloomberg News correspondent, Catherine Lucy, this during a press gaggle on Air Force One.
Quiet piggy.
To a female journalist. Again, imagine if Biden or Obama or Bush or anybody had said it like that. It's glib, I know, because we can roll our eyes and go, well, he's not there. He gets away with anything and everything. But that's the point. That is how Trump does it. He assaults our political senses. And he's been doing it even more in Trump 2. He exhausts us to the point of complete weariness. But that is how bad politicians do bad things. And therefore, it is worth considering just how different Trump 2 has been compared to Trump 1. And then there are moments which again reflect his unique character as an American president. A president who seeks to divide and not unite. All presidents are by definition political. They all have political agendas, they all have political enemies, and they have allies. But I cannot think, and this is something endemic to his particular form of populism, I cannot think of an American president who leans so consistently to invective and to darkness and to the demonization of his opponents. Something, again, which has been on full display in Trump 2. Consider Trump speaking in September at Charlie Kirk's memorial.
A missionary with a noble spirit and a great, great purpose. He did not hate his opponents. He wanted the best for them. That's where I disagreed with Charlie. I hate my opponent, and I don't want the best for them. I'm sorry. I am sorry, Erica. But now Erica can talk to me and the whole group, and maybe they can convince me that that's not right, but I can't stand my opponent.
I can't stand my opponent. I can't stand my opponent. In one sense, that reflects Trump's genius. He is authentically himself, and he is authentically a pretty small, narrow man, and he is doubtless full of dislike and invective in a way that few politicians are, at least so publicly. He does reveal that about himself. You can't accuse him in that regard of being dishonest. But again, to infuse American politics in that way is something new and something that he didn't even do much of in Trump 1. And this is my argument. This is a different sort of politician. We have become inured to it. But this is different even from what we saw in the first 4 years. He is a darker character. He's a character motivated by different impulses. He is making America into a very different sort of country and is seeking to impose that on the rest of the world. How extraordinary that at this very moment, Trump is not only naming warships after himself, but he is seizing ships from foreign countries with no legal authorization whatsoever. He's bombing that country with no legal authorization whatsoever. It creates barely a murmur in Europe, barely a murmur in Britain. We're just allowing Trump to do whatever he wants to do in the Americas and indeed in the rest of the world. Perhaps the nadir of Trump foreign policy for this year was, of course, in February when he reshared the Trump Gaza video on Truth Social. Just listen to this.
Trump Gaza shining. shine bright. Golden future, a brand new life. Haste and dance, the deal is done. Trump Gaza, number one. Trump Gaza, shining bright. Golden future, a brand new life. Haste and dance, the deal is done. Trump Gaza, number one.
We have an opportunity to do something that could be phenomenal. And I don't want to be cute. I don't want to be a wise guy. But the Riviera of the Middle East, this could be something that could be so bad. This could be so magnificent.
The Riviera of the Middle East. Well, as we know, there is barely a building left standing in Gaza. And that was done with the active connivance of the American state and the support of the American state. Trump did get the ceasefire in the end, but pretty much at the point when there was nothing left in Gaza to save. So the question, I think, for us is whether or not this second or first year of the Trump second term has been better or worse than you thought it would be. I don't know if I think it's been better or worse. I think it's been different. I think it has been madder. I think it's been more authoritarian. I think it has been more radical than even I thought it would be. And where do you think it's going to head next? 0345-6060-973. 0345-6060-973. The politics of Trump 2. Time is 10:20.
LBC.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
Say yes to summer with the biggest ever TUI sale. With a My TUI account. Say yes to flexible payment options. Say yes to free kids' places, even in the school summer holidays. With so many holiday options to choose from, you pick it, we sort it. Holiday countdown started. TUI, Atoll and app to protect it. Booking T's and C's apply. Selected departures. Minimum spend applies. Subject to availability. See website for details.
At Morrisons, our Christmas centrepieces are better than half price. Pick up a British beef joint for £6.49 per kilo, a whole leg of lamb for £7.50 per kilo, or British pork loin for £3.75 per kilo. Morrisons, making more of Christmas. Majority of stores and online excludes Morrisons Daily. Max 4 in store 2 online was £8 to £19 per kilo, ends 24th of December.
Have you noticed the way fans shout at football matches?
Oh, wake up!
That's because conveying your message with sound is the most effective way to communicate to the players on the pitch that they're rubbish. And this works in advertising too. You see, research shows how brands that use radio to amplify their advertising are 49% more likely to get noticed. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
This is LBC with Lewis Goodall. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Time is 10:22. Just on the sort of positive side of the ledger, if you were to say something positive about Trump, you have to say the one thing that he has managed to restore order to, albeit at quite some cost, is the situation on the southern border, something that Biden had started, but which Trump has certainly finished. He's also, in terms of the American economy, doing perfectly fine, although not nearly as well as he might like to think. And the tariffs, of course, that he's imposed have slowed it more than it would have gone. But if you look at the character of the Trump administration so far, this second Trump administration, as I say, I think it has been of a quite different order to that which we saw of the chaos of Trump 1. Let's talk to Mark, who is in Budapest in Hungary, who is therefore in a country which knows a thing or two about authoritarianism. Mark, good morning.
I wonder if you mean Viktor Orban by that. Yeah,
well, he was sort of somewhere in the recesses of my mind, Mark, I must confess. Of course, you've got elections there next year, so that would be very interesting.
And he's currently ahead in the elections, by the way.
Yeah.
Whatever you hear. But let me carry on. The one thing I think Trump has achieved in Europe is he's got the Europeans to spend up to 5% on GDP on their own protection. That is a big achievement rather than always looking at America for help.
Yeah. Although I think that 5% is a bit illusory, to be honest, Mark, in a lot of cases. A lot of it is there just to flatter him.
Yeah, certainly in Spain it's not going to happen.
No.
And the other aspect which I think is very important in this is that he's the only hope we've really got to stop the war in the Ukraine, because the Europeans are becoming very, very almost damning in terms of trying to continue a war with Russia. And what we need to do is to just stop it as soon as possible. I've got three children. I don't want my children going to war. when I live in Hungary, and I don't see any need for it. I don't think Russia will ever attack into NATO countries. But we've got to get a stop to this war somehow.
Well, it's been conducting plenty of hybrid warfare, Mark, across NATO countries.
They have, but equally, why
they killed
the
a British citizen on our own soil.
And they also killed a British citizen on Ukraine soil couple of weeks ago who was helping the Ukrainians with the war effort. So, I mean, there's both stories on both sides, and we don't know what the truth is. That's one thing I would say.
Well, we do know that Putin used Novichok on British soil. We also know that he was involved
No, I agree with you, but he doesn't mean we're going to go to war against him.
Well, I mean, he's...
And I don't think we will go to war against Russia.
There is one clear aggressor, isn't there, in Europe at the moment, Mark, and it's Vladimir Putin. No one's invaded him.
That's absolutely true. But I still don't believe, and most people here don't believe, that he'll ever actually go into a NATO country.
Well,
none of us believe that.
Well,
he'll only stop at Ukraine. But just let me carry on, because you asked a question about Trump.
Yeah, please.
With Trump, to me as well, is that I come from the business world, and to me, he's a business guy first, and then a politician. Mainly, you've had politicians and business guys. Everything with this guy is about a deal. Everything he ever does is about
you see,
deal.
Mark, I think that was true. I think you could make that argument more credibly in Trump 1. I think in Trump 2, he is doing things, whether it is in Venezuela, whether it's in Greenland, we're seeing today, sparking a fresh move with Denmark after appointing a special envoy to Greenland. He's doing that. I think this is a guy looking for a legacy, not just in the US, but across the world. And I think that makes him...
He's 80, he doesn't need the money.
Well,
so
in which case,
it's always the legacy argument.
Yes, but this is also he's motivated, I think, by slightly different impulses this time, and the forces around him are far more organised than they were before. They've got a far clearer agenda about what they want to do, and they are reorganising the American state in a far more effective way than they did in the first term.
Don't you think, in all fairness, that the Democrats went over the top going after him for this right, left and centre things that basically meant he had a bad temper when he started?
He
was after them from the beginning.
I think it was a difficult position in the sense that, Trump did try and overturn the 2020 election. So I think that there had to be and was always going to be some legal pushback against him for that. I think you can make an argument to say that some of the other lawsuits and so on were politically damaging. I don't think there's any two ways about that. But this is a man, Mark, of course, who decides to release 1,500 insurrectionists at the very start of the year. That was almost the first thing that he chose to do. A group of people who are now, effectively, some scholars would argue, his own personal paramilitary force in the country.
You're right on all that. The other positive thing he's done, in a sense, is helped the economy somewhat. In America, because the price of oil has now gone through the floor. And he's done that by huge amounts of drilling. Rightly or wrongly, whether you believe in green climate or whatever, he has reduced the cost of oil. And that will reduce the cost of many other things.
He's also increased, through his tariff policy, he's also increased the cost of many goods.
But in the tariff policy, don't you think it's not the worst idea in the world? Uneven the tariffs between what was coming into America and what was going out of America.
Well, in many cases,
there was a lot of imbalance in those tariffs.
Well, in many cases,
whether he went over the top, maybe.
Yes, all right, Mark in Budapest, they're grateful to you. Look, in many cases, a lot of those tariffs actually were pretty equal to begin with. But there we go. Steve is in Croydon, who has something to say about Trump. Steve, good morning.
Good morning. You mentioned about Trump's narcissism, the Kennedy Center and the fleet of ships. I mean, what frightens me more than anything about Trump are the people who surround him. You've got Caroline Leavitt. I think she does the press briefings. And it's almost as though...
She's quite the character, I think it's fair to say.
It's almost as though she's talking about the great leader in North Korea, the way she talks about Trump. And then you've got Sebastian Gorka, who I find simply very scary whenever he comes on with his pronouncements. And I just wonder what the American people think of all this. They can't be stupid to believe everything Trump is saying, and particularly when he comes out with ludicrous comments like, oh, I've had world leaders ringing me up and calling me sir. I don't think Friedrich Merz or Keir Starmer or Macron call him sir, do they?
It is very odd. I mean, look, I mean, this is, I think this is one of the things, it's a sort of small thing in a way, Steve, but I think this is, again, one of the things about the sort of second Trump administration, which is just sort of, these little things that are sort of chilling. It's these small symbolic things. It is the renaming of these American cultural sites. It is the stuff about the USS Trump. You know, no other American president would have had the gall to just sort of stand there and say, I'm going to name a whole new fleet of warship after myself. You know, even, you know, the great American leaders have never done that before. You know, they'll allow their successors to do that. It's quite typical that presidents get ships named after themselves. There's a whole suite of them. But you usually let someone else do it. The renaming, you know, the recreation, the pettiness around the sort of redecoration of the White House, filling it full of gold, filling it full of, you know, just making it look like kind of, just a kind of cheap, tawdry kind of, you know, sort of thing that we normally associate with countries of far lesser power and standing. All this sort of stuff, I just think, to me, what it's doing is just, it's remaking America in his image and thereby exactly. lessening it in the eyes of the rest of the world. Because no country, I mean, you know, the American motto is e pluribus unum, out of many one. I think Trump has taken that a little bit too literally.
And what happens to people who criticize him in the States? Is it Jake Tapper who's been heavily criticized by Trump? I mean, I listened to him on the lead in the evening, and he's hypercritical of Trump. But where are the rest of the people who are in the media, like yourself in the States, who are saying this is not right?
I think that they're, well, I mean, we know. I mean, again, this is something else that we've kind of like got used to, Stephen. This is kind of what I wanted to do the hour on the show today about this. When you sort of sit and think about it, so many things just spark across your mind. Like, oh my God, yeah, he's doing that as well. You know, this is a president. We've got used to this. This is a president who is suing and chooses to sue major media corporations. When he knows, very often, he's now doing it to the BBC, but he's done it to a whole suite of American companies. When he knows that normally he's not got a cat in house chance of succeeding, or the basis of what they've done to him, you know, it's a spurious, flimsy claim. But more often than not, they settle. They settle because they don't want it dragging through the courts forever. And more often than not, unlike the BBC, these companies have got regulatory and corporate asks of the American federal government. And so what he does is twofold. He scares them. He gets a symbolic victory. And more importantly, it sends a chill wind through the American media where you're thinking every single time, it's not so much that you don't do the reporting that what you're going to do before, but you're constantly asking yourself, could the Trump administration or someone connected to him come after me for something that I'm saying or the way that I'm saying it? And that is new. American presidents have not done that before. Well, there you go, Steve. I stunned you into silence there. Stephen Croydon, thank you very much. You know, that happens to me a lot, by the way. I should probably shut up a bit more. We're talking about Donald Trump's second term, whether it has been better or worse than you thought it would be and where you think it's heading next. 0345 60 60 973. You're listening to Lewis Goodall here on LBC. The time is 10:32. Let's get the latest LBC news headlines with Dominic Ellis.
A man's appeared in court in Swindon, charged with 56 offences against his ex-wife over a 13-year period. Philip Young, who's 49, is accused of drugging and raping Joanne Young, who's waived her anonymity. The family of a police officer injured during the Bondi Beach shooting say he's woken up from a medically induced coma. Scott Dyson was one of two officers hurt during the attack in which 15 people were killed. And there are calls to replace non-crime hate incidents with intelligence reports. Police chiefs are recommending that only the most serious cases be recorded as antisocial behaviour. LBC weather cloudy for large parts of the UK. Some outbreaks of rain in the west with a high of 10 degrees.
This is LBC.
Do it for your wife, who told you to pick up bread, but instead you picked up Fred, your grandson, again. And now your daughter is calling because he missed football. That's the fourth time this month. You can wave his future career goodbye. If you don't do it for you, do it for your wife and little Freddy.
New In, the latest custom-fit rechargeable hearing devices. Discreet, comfortable and smart enough to help you catch every moment. Book a free hearing test at bootshearingcare.com. T's and C's apply.
The new single drops. The world tour begins. As artists create the music we love, you could be right there in the mix. Calling all young creatives. If you want a career in music, then listen up. Global Academy have a new 6-4 music production course. State-of-the-art studios,
practical experience, hands-on learning with music professionals. Awesome! Apply now at globalacademy.com.
New year, new you, maybe. New year, new car, definitely. Upgrade your year with a new Vauxhall Fonterra Electric or any car from our award-winning range. With 0% APR over 4 years with a minimum 20% deposit and £1,000 off on top of all other offers. That's a resolution worth sticking to. Search Vauxhall today. £1,000 saving on new car orders ends 12th of January 2026. Personal contract purchase, 20% deposit, 18 plus. Subject to status and availability. T's and C's, Stellantis Financial Services.
At Lidl, you can get a whole Christmas dinner for eight for under £1.30 per person with all the trimmings, including fresh Birchwood British whole turkey, potatoes, Yorkshire stuffing, sprouts, carrots, parsnips, and of course the gravy. Lidl, more to value. Subject to availability, selected stores, GB only. Fresh turkeys on sale 19th of December. See lidl.co.uk/LBTV for details.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Time is 10:35. Susan has texted with a question, which I think is interesting and worth our discussion. Susan says, morning, Lewis. May I ask you, with everything you know and hear, do you seriously believe Trump will allow another free election in 2028? And if your answer is yes, do you think he will accept the outcome if he loses? I sincerely believe the USA is now a fascist dictatorship, and everyone with any sense and integrity is watching from behind the sofa. I also think, in some ways, we as a species deserve this. Nice, uplifting, festive message here, Susan. Because we hide and appease and simper and hope we're wrong, but we're not wrong. Just asleep. Sad emoji. That is a bit of a sad emoji text, actually, Susan. Bit of uplifting. I'll try and be a bit uplifting for that. I do think he'll allow a free election in 2028 because I do not think that he will be running. There is endless discussion about this, about whether he could try and avoid the constitutional requirement not to stand again, the 22nd Amendment. Maybe if he were a younger man, maybe if he were going to be a more popular man, he would try because he would sorely love to achieve something that others have not done and have a third term and be the first president since FDR to have a third term. I'm sure that would appeal to his great man sense of destiny, but the fact remains he is already an ailing president, almost an octogenarian. It's clear he doesn't quite have the energy that he once had. Still has quite a lot of energy, in fairness to him, although I always think with Biden and Trump you have the sort of two versions of aging there. Male aging, you've got the quiet man and you've got the very, very loud raving man, but Trump epitomizes that, so he appears more energetic. But you know, by the time of the next election, he's going to be well into his 80s, and I think it is clear that the bandwagon will have moved on. Something that we are already seeing. Political time in America is very fast and it is getting faster. And we are seeing already the jockeying for position within the Republican Party for the post-Trump era of 2028. He will hate that. He will try and make sure that that is deferred and postponed for as long as possible. He will keep hinting that he might run again precisely to put a deep freeze on that process. But sooner or later, political gravity will exert itself, which it is already doing with his very low approval numbers and a possible big win for the Democrats in the midterm election of 2026. So if you're not a fan of Trump, that is the optimistic take for you. Let's talk to Ned, who's in Bradfield in Essex. Ned.
Morning, Lewis. Well, you've kind of queued me up nicely there.
Oh, good. Well, it doesn't always happen, so that's handy.
Well done on that. So, actually, we spoke a year ago, and this is the reason I rang in. I thought it'll be quite timely, because the question that we chatted about probably early Jan was when he came back in, and what does Trump 2 look like? And I said that I think it'll be as exhausting as ever, and it certainly proved to be that. But also, I said to you that he'd already had a go once, and he sort of knew the parameters. I mean, there was a certain amount of legacy guardrails in place, if we remember that. I think the generals particularly seemed to be kind of keeping in track for his most egregious military moves and what have you. So I said he's going to get rid of them and surround himself with his own sycophants, which, of course, has happened. So I'm not surprised that everything has come to pass that has come to pass. But to make your point again for you was, I'm thinking about his health. And Scaramucci thinks this as well, that this thinks is a bit underreported, that, you know, he's really not in good shape. No. And I mean, we've seen him falling asleep in the meetings, and he's rambling, and, you know, he's walking and all the other stuff. So I think that the health thing is underreported.
I agree.
And that's my last thing, really, is what we've stuck with this guy now for 3 years. We've got to ask ourselves, what are we going to do about him? Because
So what you've done there, dear, is you've rung in to basically remind us that you were right.
Yeah, essentially.
Well, you know what? I respect that. I do that on the news agents every day, so that's absolutely fine. no, but you are, no, I think you're right. The underreported element on the House stuff, I think, is important. And I think, in a way, Trump is a tremendous confidence trickster, right? Like he is so good. I think one of the things that people don't understand about Trump, in a way, I've been doing it on this show. We've been talking about him as a sort of dark figure, a negative figure, someone who invokes darkness. What he's actually brilliant at is that he's actually, and this is why actually so many Americans find him appealing, he's actually in some ways a deeply sort of optimistic figure or a deeply positive figure in the sense that he is constantly selling marketing man to the end, to his bones. He's constantly selling the vision and version of reality which is in his own head, which, as long as he's associated with it, is brilliant, right? Everything's going to be the best. Everything's incredible. We've never seen anything like this before. I've won by a bigger margin than anybody before. The economy's growing bigger than ever before. We're doing better deals than we've ever had before. You know, everything is superlatives. And even though that's, like, ridiculous, it's sort of often, it's very easy to get lost in the slipstream of it. It's quite convincing after a while, right? And in a way, I think that's the same with this idea of him, you know, running again and defying even time, right? We get lost in the weird slipstream, the vortex of his own mind, and we shouldn't.
Yeah, I quite agree. But also, don't forget, as we know, he does something egregious on Monday. We all stand around gobsmacked going, did he really say that? Did he really do that? By Wednesday, he's done something else. But we're like, what the hell was that? And
but Friday, he does make he, something but, else. But Ned, for people like maybe you and me who are pretty critical of him, we have to accept, right, one of his successes, and this is true of Trump 1 and Trump 2, and he's done that, he does make people feel good.
I'm interested to find out, because I'm actually meeting a friend of mine tomorrow for lunch, who's been living in America for, oh God, the last 30 years or so. And I haven't seen her for that long, so I'm quite looking forward to sort of getting her opinion on the ground rather than getting it from social media or whatever else said sort of thing about actually kind of what the feeling might be. I've got no which way which she voted. But I'd be intrigued just to see, you know, what it's like there, is, you know, how it's that message that everything that you say is going down. Because I think the cracks are appearing. Everyone's like, you know, stop talking rubbish. You know, it's not, the eggs aren't going down.
Do you find, and I sort of ask myself this, like, you, even as a critic of him, he does make you smile, right, sometimes. He does make you smile, he does entertain you, and he's always surprising. Something that surprised me, actually, is the extent to which, and maybe this is starting to come true now, but the extent to which, in a way, we've had this shtick of his for 10 years. And yet it doesn't kind of feel old. It keeps feel like it's evolving. He still surprises, right? He still surprises, sometimes really negatively, and sometimes really positively. I'm just going to play this clip now. And I think this epitomizes in the positive sense of what I mean. When he met Mamdani and everyone was like, oh my God, this is going to be a showdown. He's going to go for Mamdani. And instead, this is what happened.
Are you affirming that you think President Trump is a fascist?
I've spoken about...
That's okay. You can just say yes.
Okay.
It's easier. It's easier than explaining it. I don't mind.
Like, that's charming, right? Like, that's not only funny, it's charming and surprising and quite beguiling.
It's very out of character, isn't it? To, you know, from calling someone a piggy, like, the day before.
Yeah.
Or Rob Reiner, like, the week after.
But I don't think it is out of character, is it? He can be very charming. He can be, and everyone says this who meets him, but also, he can be when... I mean, I think, actually, with Mamdani, I actually thought that might... I'm going to do a you now, Ned, and say that was right all along. I actually thought that might happen because... I think, you know, Trump likes a winner, and he likes big personalities, and I think on some level he would have thought, Mamdani is almost a bit in my image, but in the other direction, right? He's great on social media, he's all that sort of stuff. And he's sort of very much a product of the age of Trump, which I think Trump would have liked. But he can be, surprisingly, when he wants to be, he can be surprisingly self-effacing and surprisingly kind of charming and surprisingly entertaining. And if he wasn't those things sometimes, he wouldn't have achieved what he has politically. Maybe we have to accept that, though, critics of his.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he is a showman. He knows his marketing backwards and forwards. I mean, we can't look on for that. And he knows how to, I said, with all the press conferences that he constantly has that are sort of cabinet meetings that aren't and what have you. But, and the way that he signs everything by executive order, I mean, I don't understand how, do I ever see any Congress voting on anything? I mean, maybe that doesn't get reported. But I am just very wary of him. As was this first term, it's like, what is tomorrow going to bring? Yes. And it just makes me nervous, you know.
I understand, Ned. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll speak in a year's time and we'll see if you were right again. Ned in Bradfield there. Mike is in Hull, has something to say about this. Good morning, Mike.
Hi, morning, Lewis. Good morning. First time caller, I'm a bit nervous, sorry.
Oh, well, no, nothing to be nervous about. James isn't here, just me, don't worry.
But, yeah, I was listening to your previous call, Ned, and, like, a lot of the sort of, the talk about the Mamdani situation, like, I think it's when it's someone that he knows that he's not going to be able to sort of dominate, he shuts down or he's sort of more wary of, like, as I spoke to your researchers, I've got my wife's American from California, and she's a Democrat, and she despises what Trump did in his first term and what he's doing now. But her mum is a Republican, and she's not like a full on Trump supporter, but she does agree with some of his policies.
Yeah,
and it causes a bit of a rift between them, where the my wife basically told her mum, look, you're part of that sort of, I don't think you realise that you're in a cult, with the MAGA cult.
You know, Mike, just to interrupt, sorry, this is something that is actually, again, a bit underreported, I think, and something that is so common in America. I was in Indiana last year doing some reporting from Indiana, went into this bar and got talking to this couple, guy in there, you know, been lifelong Republicans, you know, they were probably in their 70s. It was actually, I think, their sort of 46th wedding anniversary or something. But you know, lucky them, see it running into us. But anyway, he was saying, you know, country club Republican all his life, all sort of thing. He'd had a brother, a couple of brothers. You know, they had lost not only friends, but family members, brothers, right? Yeah. Because they felt, even though they were Republican, both of them felt that they'd slipped down the rabbit hole of each other, right? The one had been radicalized, went full on MAGA. And it was like the couple were like, the thing is, even though we started out all as Republicans, it started to get to the point where we couldn't even agree on the basic precepts of truth. You know, we couldn't even agree that, you know, I mean, even if we tried not to talk about politics, before you knew where you would be, you know, it would be stuff about how, you know, Obama was actually kind of, you know, a Muslim, and he was from Kenya, and he'd been put there by you know, the CIA, all this sort of stuff. Or that, you know, and as we were walking out, you know, a guy comes up to us, someone we've been having a completely civil conversation with, and he just goes, so are you going to get the money from Nancy Pelosi? I said, what are you talking about? I said, well, Pelosi sent you, hasn't she? And it's just like this kind of level of kind of radicalism and conspiracy is just hard to deal with, but it's really common and happened to your family, and I think very commonplace across the US now.
Yeah, like, before my wife moved over here 2 years, like just under 2 years ago, we was looking at possibly me going there, and then with the situation and how it was changing, I weighed up my options and said, look, the way it is with the gun situation, the medical and stuff like that, you're better off here. Mm. And it was like, because of the changes that the government were doing with the what you had to earn for the visa,
yes,
we had to sort of put a rush job onto it to get her across.
Right, I see.
Because I only earned 27,000 roughly.
Right.
So I'd have been under the 38,000 threshold, but then that got changed.
How does your wife, if I was speaking to your wife now, Mike, and I was speaking to her about Trump, how would she talk about him? How does she feel about him?
She's embarrassed and disgusted by what he's doing.
Because it went, really? Go on.
She spends a lot of her time on TikTok.
Right.
She sends me a lot of the videos. It's like people that obviously call him out, and she sent little things to her mum where her mum's posted something on Facebook like in support of what Trump's doing, and it causes a bit of a rift, and she sort of she don't get how a mum could, her values seem to have changed from, she used to have an uncle, he's no longer with us, but he was gay and with all the DEI and LGBTQ like persecution that they seem to be doing, she said, "I can't believe my mum would be like that, because it was one of her favourite people," and she's just sort of turning a blind eye to it.
I think, Mike, just briefly, I think that is, you're hitting on one of the really distinctive parts of Trump too, as well, which is really important to bring into the discussion, which is the development, the evolution of, the creation of completely separate media ecosystems. And completely different, as a result, conceptions of reality and of just of truth, which was the glimmers of that were there in Trump 1. But even in Trump 1, which, you know, now is going on for, you know, 10 years ago, the established broadcast media and print media were still more powerful than they are now. You know, social media was, you know, strong, but still relative to where it is now in its infancy. The fragmentation which has taken place has basically allowed Americans to have completely competing visions of reality, which Trump has exploited mercilessly. Mike in Hull, grateful to you. We'll continue this conversation about Donald Trump. And maybe you disagree with me that Trump will allow American democracy to endure into 2028. If so, 0345-6060973. You're listening to Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien here on LBC. The time is 10:49.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
Let's be generous. It is nearly Christmas after all. You are minded to think that 5 years isn't long enough in the grand sweep of a country's history to do anything. We've had significant political upheaval in that time, so we've not really given it a good go on our own to say, God, to run back to mummy again and join a customs union. We need to give it longer. So what's the it? The it is proper trade deal with the United States? Better trade deal with South Korea? I don't know.
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Thanks for the key deliverables, David. Now, who'd like to
stay out all night? Yahoo!
That's brilliant. So, okay, sales targets. Are we hitting
the dance floor? Party time! Woo-hoo!
There's more than one you, and with Specsavers 2-for-1, you can choose glasses for at least two yous. From £70 with standard single vision lenses.
Nice moves, David!
Book an appointment at specsavers.co.uk. Conditions apply.
So, close your eyes. Picture the scene. Just you and me, alone, enjoying breakfast on our own little island. Sounds perfect, right?
Yeah.
Great, because I've booked Wix to design our new kitchen.
At Wix, we have over 80 kitchen styles to choose from, with prices from under £3,000. And, right now, find big savings in the Wix kitchen sale. Book a free design appointment and feel as proud as a peacock with Wix. Terms apply.
Do you have a Co-op card or membership number? In July, Co-op CEO confirmed that the personal data of all 6.5 million members was accessed in a major cyber attack. If you're a member, your information may have been exposed, and you could be entitled to compensation through a group action claim. Check your eligibility today at jointheclaim.com. It's quick, secure, and easy to do online at jointheclaim.com.
This Christmas, McDonald's and the Elf on the Shelf are bringing festive tasks to your little ones, like writing a Christmas card for your postie.
Thank you. You're one happy helper.
Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 30th of December, from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy. While stocks last, subject to availability, fair ordering policy applies.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
New year, new you. Maybe. New year, new car. Definitely. Upgrade your year with a new Vauxhall Fonterra Electric or any car from our award-winning range. With 0% APR over 4 years with a minimum 20% deposit and £1,000 off on top of all other offers. That's a resolution worth sticking to. Search Vauxhall today. £1,000 saving on new car orders until the January 2026. Personal contract purchase, 20% deposit, 18 plus. Subject to status and availability. T's and C's, Stellantis Financial Services.
Leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Time is 10:52. A little bit of breaking news. US Department of Justice has just released another tranche of documents relating to the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The latest batch contains thousands of files, including images and investigative documents. It follows the passing of a law, of course, in Congress mandating the so-called Epstein files be released in their entirety by last Friday. As I say, upwards of 11,000 documents, and these apparently include nearly 400 videos, evidence spreadsheets, part clippings, audio files. The file is 10 gigs in size, the largest of the tranches to be released to date. So doubtless reporters all over the world will be poring over those. We'll bring you the latest when we have it on LBC. I have another story for you now. A former councillor has appeared in court accused of a string of sexual offences against his ex-wife over a 13-year period. Helen Hognott, LBC reporter, is with us now. Helen, tell us about this.
So, Lewis, in the last hour, 49-year-old Philip Young, formerly of Swindon, now of North London, appeared at Swindon Magistrates Court. He appeared in the dock dressed in a pair of dark blue jeans and a black zip-up jumper and spoke to confirm his name and address. He's charged with 56 offences against his former spouse, 48-year-old Joanne Young, including multiple counts of rape and administering a substance with intent to stupefy or overpower power to allow sexual activity, as well as voyeurism, possession of indecent images of children and possession of extreme images. Miss Young has waived her right to anonymity. Mr. Young told the judge today that he didn't want to enter a plea before he was remanded into custody ahead of an appearance at Swindon Crown Court scheduled to take place on January the 23rd, 2026. And he didn't react as an officer handcuffed him and took him down to the cells. He's among six men due to appear in court today, charged with offences against Miss Young between 2010 and 2023. The other five defendants are 47-year-old Dean Hamilton of No Fixed Abode. Police have shared the ethnicities of these men. He's described as white British. 47-year-old Norman McSoney of Sharnbrook, Bedfordshire, described as a black British national. 31-year-old Connor Sanderson Doyle, a white British man. 61-year-old Richard Wilkins, also white British. And 37-year-old Mohammed Hassan, described as British Asian. Those last three are all of Swindon. They are due to appear at Swindon Magistrates Court this afternoon. They are also charged with sexual offences against Joanne Young, including rape and sexual assault. Now, ahead of the court appearance earlier today, Jeff Smith, the Detective Superintendent for Wiltshire Police, has said this is a significant update in what is a complex and extensive investigation. The victim in this case, Joanne, has taken the decision to waive her automatic legal right to anonymity. Mr. Smith continued that she has been supported by specially trained officers from the beginning of the process, and she made the decision following multiple discussions with officers and support services to waive her anonymity.
Helen Hodnott there, LBC reporter, bringing us the latest on that pretty extraordinary story. Before we close out this question about Donald Trump, I think it's worth reflecting on one other thing. I see a lot of you have been getting in touch basically questioning kind of where the movement, the MAGA movement, goes next. And again, as I say, saying that perhaps Trump is going to try and dismantle American democracy. I think there is a very good reason, and famous last words here, but I think there is very good reason going into 2026 to believe that the MAGA movement may have peaked. Why do I say that? Well, I think the MAGA movement is in danger of doing exactly what liberalism did, wokeness did, for want of a better expression, in the early part of this decade, which is commit significant overreach, particularly cultural overreach. It is absolutely true that woke liberals, again for want of a better expression, at sometimes decided to be too censorious about what people were saying, too controlling about people's language, and that allowed a space to develop where people like the MAGA movement could come along and say they are trying to tell you what to think, what to say, what to do. The problem with that, of course, is twofold. They ended up, are now in a position, the MAGA lot, of saying that basically anything is fair game. And as soon as you say that there are no limits on free speech, then you end up inviting some very unsavory people into your movement. There is a self-radicalization about this whole thing, not least because if you base your movement on the idea that we can say anything, it's almost like someone just looking for that next drink, the hit of the first drink, in a way. You're constantly basically trying to find the thing that is that little bit more offensive, that little bit more racist, that little bit more sexist. And before you know where you are, the MAGA movement is debating whether or not Nick Fuentes, a well-known white supremacist, Hitler sympathizer, an anti-Semite, lots of people accusing him of that, very, very clear, saying that Hitler is great and Hitler is to be admired and all of these sorts of things, saying that Jews are unassimilable in American society and responsible for all sorts of woes within American society, classic old school right wing anti-Semitism. MAGA finds itself debating whether or not he should be legitimate, fair game, part of the movement. That was the ridiculous spectacle that we saw over the course of the weekend at the Turning Point USA event. This was, of course, Charlie Kirk's event. It was being held almost as a sort of pilgrimage for him in lots of ways. And you saw basically that event where you had all of the kind of denizens of the MAGA movement, the big influencers, the conservative content creators and so on, basically end up at war, discussing, debating, arguing, taking seven lumps out of each other over the question about who should be allowed in, what should be allowed to say, and whether there should be any limits on free speech. And very often sounding entirely mad and full of conspiracy. This was the director of National Intelligence, so she's part of the US federal government. Tulsi Gabbard blaming the deep state for there being no peace.
But what I've seen over these months is that every time they make progress and they move closer and closer to that hope for peace, the warmongers in the deep state step up and try to do everything they can to stop them. Predictably, they use the same old tactics that they've always used. The deep state within the intelligence community weaponizes intelligence to try to undermine progress. They leak it to their friends in the mainstream propaganda media to try to spread this and push a false narrative. They foment fear and hysteria as a way to justify the continuing of the war and their efforts to undermine President Trump's efforts towards peace, and do so specifically in this case in order to try to pull the U.S. military into a direct conflict with Russia, which is ultimately what the EU and NATO want. We cannot allow this to happen. We have to see clearly what's happening before our very eyes and stand united in this cause of peace.
Meanwhile, at the same event, you had, as I say, held in a way as a pilgrimage to, in honor of Charlie Kirk, the late Charlie Kirk, you had the conservative commentator Candace Owens publicly questioning the accepted account of Kirk being killed by a lone gunman, suggesting there is a larger truth about it. Erica Kirk, the widow of Charlie Kirk, has told her to stop spreading such theories. She didn't. That, including at the same event, extremist commentators, far-right influences promoting anti-Semitic theories, blaming Israel or Zionist actors for Kirk's killing. It goes on, it goes on, and it goes on. Conspiracy within conspiracy within conspiracy theory. And this, I think, ultimately, is MAGA's biggest frailty. It is consuming itself. The forces that propelled it to political power are in danger of collapsing it. Interesting theme for 2026. Doubtless we'll be talking about it next December. Coming up, we're going to be talking about something a little bit closer to home. Can you earn £80,000 and still be considered working class? That's coming up. The time's 11:01.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, a man's been remanded into custody after being charged with 56 offences against his ex-wife over a 13-year period. Philip Young, who's 49 and originally from Swindon, is accused of drugging and raping Joanne Young, who's waived her anonymity. LBC's reporter Thea Rickard has more from Swindon Magistrates Court.
Philip Young is among six men due to appear in court today, charged with offences against Ms. Young between 2010 and 2023. We're expecting those other five men to appear here at Swindon Magistrates Court this afternoon. 49-year-old Philip Young was told to attend Swindon Crown Court on January the 23rd next year.
Officials in Ukraine say there are widespread power cuts across the country after Russia carried out a massive air attack. Three people, including a child, were killed in the strikes overnight. It follows a weekend of peace talks where Ukrainian and Russian envoys met separately with their American counterparts. Donald Trump has claimed the release of the Jeffrey Epstein files are damaging to those who innocently met the late sex offender. The US president has spoken for the first time since last week's release of documents. The publication's been criticised, though, after many files were heavily redacted. Speaking to reporters in Florida, Mr. Trump also denied ever visiting Jeffrey Epstein's private Caribbean island.
A lot of people are very angry that pictures are being released of other people that really had nothing to do with Epstein, but they're in a picture with him because he was at a party, and you ruin a reputation of somebody. But I never went there, but a lot of people did go there.
It's reported Andrew Mountbatten Windsor has had his gun licence revoked ahead of an expected house move in the new year. The decision follows a security review with specialist police officers. It means the former prince can only use or transport his firearms under strict expert supervision. And police leaders will reportedly pressure the Home Secretary in the new year to scrap non-crime hate incidents. Officers will warn that recording them undermines freedom of speech and diverts officers away from fighting crime. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up four at 98.70. The pound buys $1.35 and a euro 14. LBC weather, cloudy for large parts of the UK, some outbreaks of rain in the west with a high of 10 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission. And it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 11:04. Well, whatever we think of Donald Trump and his politics and what he's done in Trump 2 versus Trump 1, we can all agree that he is part of the plutocratic class. He is a billionaire. He has become far wealthier. His family have become enriched as a result of his political activities beyond most people's wildest dreams. Nonetheless, he has tremendous appeal with America's working class and indeed arguably in other places around the world as well. And that sort of says something maybe about the changing nature of class and the importance of culture and class and the way that we talk and the way that we act. It's not just about money. And that is sort of what I want to talk to you about in this hour of the show. And I don't know, it's one of those ones where I've got a sort of personal view of it because I've kind of got a bit skin in the game, which I can tell you about. And I've got sort of strong feelings about class and about heritage and about these things. But to be honest, an ambivalence in my own mind about what it means for me. But let me just tell you about it. This is the children of train drivers who earn $80,000 a year are going to be able to benefit from social mobility schemes because the job is considered to be working class. But police officers and prison staff earning half their salary are not. The ONS, the Office for National Statistics, of course, which created the system used to determine social class, categorizes driving trains among working class, quotes, lower supervisory and technical occupations. And that is so regardless of how much they get paid. So that means that children of train drivers would be eligible for a civil service social mobility scheme, something that created a little bit of controversy you might remember earlier in the year, if their parents had that job when they were 14. Just to remind you about that scheme, because the Tories criticised it, perhaps unsurprisingly. In the summer, ministers announced plans to restrict applicants to the Civil Service Summer Internship Programme to students solely from working-class backgrounds, which Labour argued would help ensure that the civil service, Whitehall, reflected the country that it governs. So other professions considered to be working class for that scheme include receptionists, shop assistants, electricians, butchers, plumbers, waiters. But police and prison officers, as well as teachers, were considered middle class, intermediate occupations. The programme, as I say, is open to students in their final 2 years of university. So basically what this means is, and what this is saying is that class is about more than just how much your parents earn. Something that I feel quite strongly is true for reasons that maybe we can discuss. But what it means, of course, is that let's take train drivers and tube drivers. As a result of a pretty good deal that has been negotiated by their union, the RMT, tube drivers' salaries are going to reach 80,000 by 2028. Drivers at London North Eastern Railway, LNER, are set to earn up to 80,000 after a deal to avoid strike action. Eurostar drivers earn an average of £87,000 a year, which, you know, puts you in the well in the top, I think, decile in terms of income distribution in the country. Certainly the top two deciles. Police officers, meanwhile, who would be considered middle class in this, earn between £30,000 and £48,000, depending on their experience. Prison officers earn between £35,000 and £44,000. So they could earn, well under half, potentially, of a train driver, but their children, the prison officer's child, would not be eligible for these schemes because of basically their occupation being considered to be middle class, bourgeois, to use the old Marxist term. And this is creating a little bit of controversy. Indeed, Baroness Anderson, a government whip in the House of Lords, has been asked by the Conservative Lord Jackson of Peterborough whether train drivers are a working class in a parliamentary question. Now, the government is defending all of this. And in a way, the question of the scheme is somewhat sort of parochial or somewhat trivial compared to the overall thing. Because to me, this gets to the heart of class as an issue. And the reason I sort of say I'm sort of ambivalent about it, or it sort of cuts me to the quick or the core in a way, which is that, you know, I'm from a very working class background. My dad was a welder. My mum was a midwifery assistant. And, you know, sort of very proudly working class. It's a big part of my culture. If someone describes me as middle class, part of me bristles. I don't like it. I associate middle class with people that probably as a kid I slightly resented, or it sort of implies to me somehow that, you know, maybe you're part of the economy or part of politics that I don't really want to be in. My whole heritage, my whole background, culturally, all of it, my way that I was brought up, the school that I went to, it was all working class in South Birmingham, and proudly so. It's a sort of big part of my identity. And yet, you know, let's be honest, let's be real. By any definition, so the economic definition, can I be working class? Well, probably not. Certainly not in terms of, oh, I'm coming, you know, I get well paid. You know, I sort of live in London. I sort of mix in political media circles. These are not sort of bastions by any traditional element of working class life. But there's always a bit of you that sort of looks back and feels uncomfortable about being told that you have to leave behind something, even when you don't want to, that was such a big part of your own identity. So my question, in a way, is whether class is about more than just money. Can someone who earns 80,000 or 100,000 or 150,000 or whatever it happens to be, can you still be working class? Or is it about more than just money? And I would say that there is an argument to say that there is a way that you could be. And it's this. It's that class is always more about, for me, power and security. It's not about your monthly pay. An 80,000 salary, it might sound affluent, but class is about control over your time. It's about risk. It's about your ability to absorb shocks. It's about whether you are wealthy, not just that you have a big income. It's whether you have to work for your living or not. It's whether you might expect to receive a massive inheritance, which, alas, I don't, which might have something to do with my previous views on this station of 100% inheritance tax threshold, but we'll leave that to one side. We're not getting into that little quagmire all over again. It's whether you have to live off your labour or whether you have to live on your assets. Someone who's on 80,000, they're going to have to work to pay off their mortgage. And if they lose their income because they're ill or they're sacked and they have no capital behind them and they have no wealth behind them and they have no family wealth behind them, they're completely dependent on selling their own labour. Is that not the classic definition of working class? For me, class is, and maybe I would say this, is at least as much about wealth as it is about income. It's at least as much about where you sit in the structure of society as much as it is where you sit on the income distribution. Income tells you how much you earn this year. Wealth tells you where your money has come from, and not just your money, but your family's money over not just your lifetime, but the lifetime before that and the lifetime before that. Still something that to this day overwhelmingly often determines your life chances. Something that for me is a complete national scandal. We still have a country where the vast majority of professions, whether it is the media or the law or politics or whatever it happens to be, medicine, science, academia, you name it, is overwhelmingly dominated by people from wealthy backgrounds, people who went to private schools. Social mobility in this country very often, too often, is a joke. And that is about class. It's about, because we've got a society where it is harder to break through the class divisions of wealth. And that is something that we should talk about. And there is also something about being told that you have to sort of abandon your entire family, that you can't sort of be what you have always been and consider yourself to be. My view is, put my cards on the table here, I think if you have to work to survive, then you have a reasonable definition of saying that you are working class. If your assets work for you, you're not, regardless of your salary, right? I mean, that to me, I mean, like, to think about it this way, you could have two people on 80,000 a year in utterly different classes. Person A, 80,000 salary, 20,000 savings, large mortgage, no family wealth. Person B, 80,000 salary, 1.2 million house owned outright, 500,000 invested, inheritance expected. They're not in the same class. If we just talk about income, they both earn the same income, so we'd say they're middle class. But they can't possibly be in the same class, can they? Because you've got one person with massive inherited wealth, massive assets, massive house, that's everything that's just been gifted to them, and then one person who is one dodgy paycheck away, or one illness away, or one, you know, recession away from ruin, from destitution. We can't possibly say, surely, that they are in the same class. So what I want to talk to you about is whether you think class is about more than just money. And if that is the case, what is it about? Can you have someone who is on 80,000 or 100,000 or 120,000 or whatever it happens to be, can you earn that money and still be considered working class? Do you consider yourself working class even if you are in that category? Is it about culture? Is it about heritage? Is it about history? Or is it about the have and the have-nots, the wealthy and the non-wealthy? 0345 6060973. 0345 6060973. It's a bit of a personal thing, but it's also something that I think cuts to the core of where we are in our economy, because we talk as if class is almost as it always used to be, which is neatly divided, neatly defined. But the truth is, for me at least, this is about wealth and it's about not having wealth. And so, yeah, I can see a world where train drivers' kids should be allowed on those schemes and other people in more middle-class occupations traditionally aren't. Your thoughts? 0345 6060973. Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien on LBC. The time is 11:15.
LBC.
The big day is almost here, and you know what that means. Turkey. Well, not just turkey. M&S British free-range turkey crown with a pork, cherry and chestnut stuffing glazed with maple syrup infused with chilli, cinnamon, clove and nutmeg. It also means Cornish cruncher cauliflower cheese with Emmental pecorino and mozzarella. And British baby parsnips with maple syrup glaze with polenta and pecorino. This is not just food. This is M&S Christmas food. Selected stores.
When you go abroad, everyone knows the best way to make yourself understood is to just say everything in English, but louder.
Four beers, please, garçon!
If only there was a way that could work with your advertising campaign. Well, there is. And you're listening to it. Because when you amplify your advertising with radio, 40 million listeners every week get the message. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
You know, sometimes you just want to mosey. Travel your own road. Slow things down a mite. Meet the locals and smell the coffee. So friends, take time to sit down with the folks at Little America and let them tailor-make your trip to Canada and the U.S., just the way you like it. For slow travel that nourishes the soul, head to littleamerica.co.uk.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Time is 11:16. Just very, very briefly, the only thing I'd say about class, and I can see a few people here, say, Beatrice, oh, Lewis, you're so middle class now, you have working class heritage, but today you're so middle class in aspiration, in attitude, in lifestyle, in earnings. What does middle class and aspiration mean? What, wanting to do well? This annoys me, right? It really annoys me when people talk as if middle class people, it's like when they saved to send their kids to private schools, as if because they aspired, as if like they're the only people who've got any aspiration. I think working class people have had aspiration throughout entire history to get out into better jobs, better homes. I don't think aspiration is middle class. As soon as we start getting into that, we just get into the sort of realms of snobbery and absurdity. And I tell you what, although I do accept that clearly I'm not in the position that my parents were when I was growing up, or I'm not in the position that I was when I was growing up, I do resent, you know, often this happens, you know, people will say, oh, Lewis, you're so working middle class now. A lot of these people often are people with huge wealth, huge inheritance, who basically had a lot given to them throughout their lives. I do sort of slightly resent being told I'm in the same class as them, because I wasn't, and I'm not. Anyway, Sam is in Reading. Sam.
Hi. I just want to challenge the image that you're portraying of what you're calling middle-class people. My husband and I, we live in a house that will get slammed for mansion tax, but we bought that ourselves. We've got a massive mortgage. My husband's parents came over on the boat from India. His dad worked as a bus conductor. His mum made the little silver foil bits that you put in the top of coffee jars. They scrimped and saved. They all lived in one room for years so that they could send their boys to university. Now, my husband chose to do a certain degree at university. He's got a decent job, earns what a lot of people would say is an eye-watering amount of money. We live in a big house, but we've done that all ourselves. And then people like you are on the radio and implying that people like us are freeloaders and not paying our tax.
When did I say
we're
that?
The only people who are worthy of the title of being grafters and hardworking are people who are earning under a certain amount.
I didn't say any of that, Sam. I think you might have been listening to a different radio station.
No,
I haven't said any of that.
I'm listening to a different radio station. It's like you're almost ashamed of your middle classes. Why do you have to be ashamed of it? Why do you have to be ashamed of this badge? You know, you're a journalist, for God's sake. It's a middle class profession.
But just,
I find it offensive.
Sam, I find it offensive. You telling me what class I am, actually, if we're going to go down the offensive guard.
Well,
okay, so
journalist.
Now listen. So what? You see, there are no working class journalists. You're saying that it's a middle class profession, that working class people can't become journalists.
It's a middle class profession.
Well, it hasn't always been. There have been loads of people, by the way, working class people who've worked in local papers and goodness knows what, so that's not true. But you're saying to me, right, if it's based on the basis of income and profession, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor currently has no profession, no income. On that basis, is he more working class than I am?
Oh my gosh, come on, let's just shove him. People like that are on a whole different level.
Well, you're saying it's about income.
No, I'm saying that you're saying about people with wealth. I have wealth. I have a house that's worth a lot of money.
Yeah,
but
good for you.
I paid for that myself. I've worked my backside off. My husband's worked his backside off. No one gave
you had no inherited wealth.
No, not a penny.
If you actually listened to what I said, Sam, then you would have heard that you were in the category that I was describing, which is that you're potentially one bad paycheck or one recession away because you've got no wealth that you can fall back on. But the fact of the matter is, Sam, if we look at these statistics, I know people get very upset about talking about wealth, but wealth in Britain is a scandal. In Great Britain, the wealthiest 10% of households own 43% of all the wealth. The bottom 50% of people in this country own only 9% of the wealth. Are you really saying that's because the top 10% have just worked so much harder than the bottom 50%?
No, I'm not saying that my husband worked harder than anyone or that I work harder, but I work as hard. And so that's my point. What I don't like is that people vilify us because we're in that top 1%, which we probably are actually, but we pay an absolute fortune in tax.
Sam, I don't understand. I've not vilified you. Half of the things that you've accused me of saying, I haven't said. All I've said is that in my opinion, which I'm entitled to have, and you're entitled to disagree with me, in my opinion, the big class barrier in this country now, which matters most, more than culture or the way we talk, is about whether or not you have wealth or you do not have wealth.
And that is an important...
Well, please do.
So I live in a house, let's say for argument's sake, it's worth £2 million.
Yeah.
And someone else lives in a house that's worth, I don't know, 400 grand. I live in the southeast of England. I live in a really expensive area. But why should I feel guilty that I live in this house that I work for and they live in that house?
But Sam, no one said you should feel guilty. What I'm saying is,
you're saying that it's not right with the distribution of wealth. What are you saying? I should be giving even more of what we're earning away.
I do think we need to tax wealth. I do think we need to tax wealth far more. Yes, I think we should tax income less and we should tax wealth more, because too many people in this country, I'm not saying that this is you, but it does happen, more and more people, and this is something that happened a lot in the 19th century, more and more people basically live off unearned earnings.
But you seem to be angry about me saying things I haven't said.
I can tell you're livid.
They want to come after our house with this wealth tax and all with this mansion tax and all this stuff. Where the hell does it end? We've got a mortgage that would literally keeps me awake at night.
But you didn't have to have that mortgage, Sam. You could have chosen a different house.
No,
I mean, like, I'm sorry. I'm not going to feel sorry for you.
I'm not asking you. you to feel sorry for me, but I'm saying that I'm paying my way, and I'm paying everyone else's way. As my husband is paying more in tax than, you know, some people earn, which lucky us. But it's just I'm sick and tired of people sort of making out that we're the bad guys when we're not. We're doing everything by the book, absolutely.
But I've literally not said, Sam, that you're the bad guy. My problem is with inherited wealth. My problem is with wealth which people haven't deserved to earn.
Have you got kids?
No.
So I would love to hear how you'd feel about inherited wealth.
I'd feel exactly the same. You know why, Sam? I'd feel exactly the same. You know why? Because I would want my kids to make their own way in the world, and I wouldn't want them thinking that they're...
Envy. I'm going to end it there. I wish you a happy Christmas.
Well, it sounds like you're having a very festive time. Yeah. Cheers, Sam. Thanks for that. Tim is in Maidstone. Tim.
Hi. How are you?
I'm all right. Thanks. How are you, Tim?
I'm good. Yeah. I can see some of her points of view. She's worked hard for her money, and why should you have 100% wealth tax? I haven't got a mortgage. I'm not wealthy. My kind of wealth is, if my washing machine breaks, I can buy a new washing machine. If I want to go on holiday, I can afford a holiday.
Yeah.
To me, that's wealth.
Yeah.
Class to me is first class thing. I agree with you. Massive wealth from your grandfather gave you this money. It gives him a silver spoon, which is so annoying. But that's the way it is. That's not their fault that they were given this money.
No, it's not their fault, but they've also not deserved it. So I think it's fair game to tax it in a world. I would much rather, we started getting into a conversation I got in some trouble for a while ago, but let's do it anyway. I would much rather, Tim, tax people's wealth and income from wealth that they haven't done anything to earn than tax people's income that they're working every hour God sends every day in the week. Because, not least because, actually, in terms of growth, it is a huge disincentive. Having high taxes on income is a big disincentive to work more and produce more, as opposed to what we should be really doing, which is taxing wealth that isn't necessarily earned.
I agree with some of the parts you say. It's same as like the farmer's tax. I disagree with the farmer's tax. I'm not a farmer. I'm a retired fireman. I agree. Most farmers' wealth is in their property and their machinery. If one of them died, they have to sell land to keep their own family back. It's just such a strange scenario. It's just a strange way of...
I just wonder,
to generate cash.
Yeah, I just wonder if we think... I mean, look, again, I just go back to that stat, Tim. You know, the wealthiest 10% of households in this country own 43%, nearly all of the wealth. The bottom 50% collectively only around 9% of the wealth. I just don't see... Unless we are saying that the bottom 50% have just not worked hard enough, and the top 10% have worked harder, then something must be unjust in the system, mustn't it? There must be something going wrong that needs to be addressed. Because if we care about having a more equal society, then we need to do something about it, don't we?
I think the 50%, you know, the lower paid one, is because that's where they've been brought up in the social... I mean, I was brought up in social housing. We're brought up, the job you're going to get, you're going to work in a machine shop, you're going to work, be a chippy, you're going to be an electrician, you know. Something she said about, you know, politicians have come from, you know, private schools, which, and is who you know for the big jobs. And we all agree with that. But, you know, the under 50% social work hard. Most work hard. The social ones are on the social. Half of them have been born not to work. Which is frightening, I think.
What do you mean? Were you saying that people are being born not to work? What do you mean?
Well, like, in some states near me, people generally lived in their mother and father's house are on social. They're on social because they're trained to be the same. Not all of them.
But just, I mean, Tim, I mean, we go back to what Sam was saying before. I mean, I don't understand. A lot of the wealth of this country is locked up in houses, in property, right? Now,
yes.
A lot of people will say, as we heard from Sam there, look, I've got a mortgage on this, and I bought this house, and this house has gone up in value by this, and now we're getting a mansion tax. I mean, I don't want to be unfair here, but if you've bought a house and it's gone up in value, you know, in value by 40% or 50%, which, by the way, was a massive generational windfall. Younger generations today aren't going to experience that. Older ones didn't either, but it was a huge generational windfall. You've not done anything to earn that. You've not done anything. You've not made some really smart move. You just owned a house, which happens have gone up enormously, partly because younger generations have not had enough houses built for them. People who are living in those houses are literally benefiting from the fact that there is a dearth of supply of houses. So why shouldn't we tax some of that windfall?
Something I do. It's the lady one before you. Like she's had no wealth from her family, which same as me, and she's built
same
up
as me.
For herself. Yes, which great, fair play. But she's brought it up for herself. She shouldn't be taxed on a wealth tax that she has been.
I think. I tell you what, Tim. I think the three of us, you, me, Sam, should all get taxed less on our income. Which, given that we're all from nothing, we have decided to. You know, we've worked hard to get for ourselves, and that's true for others out there. And I think people who are handed things and assets and so on, just because either their parents or great grandparents or whatever it happens to be. For nothing, I think that should get taxed far more. I think people who are in houses, whose houses have gone up by 50, 60, 100, 200%, just by sitting in them in the bricks and mortar for 30 or 40 years, just because it was in the right place at the right time, and because younger generations have been denuded the right of having a house of their own, I think that should be taxed more. So, yeah, I think income, tax it less, and wealth and windfalls, tax it more.
I disagree. I think we should be taxed more. I think we should be... say 1% tax more across the board.
What, so even poor people. So all the people who are, you know, working their backsides off, who haven't had a single penny given to them their entire life, should pay more tax. So little Lord Fauntleroy can inherit his estate of a 400 million quid or whatever it is and not pay any tax on that at all. Is that fair?
You're missing my point. What I'm saying is, if we all have a tax slightly higher, the rich pay more tax.
Not necessarily. Depends what their income is. Doesn't
it? That's what I'm saying. For their income, if their income is £100,000, they will pay more tax than I will on £30,000 a year.
Yes, but the same percentage could end up being very similar. Not least the fact that at the moment we tax wealth, generally speaking, less than we tax income, and income from wealth less than we tax income. So in the end, you could have a situation where incredibly wealthy people are paying more or less as a percentage of tax, as we saw, for example, with Rishi Sunak's tax returns when they were published, than a young graduate who's basically paying 40% when you include student loan and marginal rates of tax, national insurance and so on, for nearly 40% of their income on 40,000 a year or 30,000 or what it is. How can that be fair?
The way I look at it is we have choices.
Well, you don't have choices about which family you're born into. You don't have any choice
that. I was born into a very poor family, and I was brought up to work hard and earn. And that's how all my family have done this, you know. None of my family have ever been unemployed. And I've got six brothers and sisters. And that's through how we were brought up.
Well, it's also about a bit of luck. There are plenty of people, Tim, who end up unemployed who would love to be employed.
It's not about a bit of luck.
It is a bit, Tim. It is. Oh, come on, Tim. Are you honestly saying that in the grand history... In the 1980s, there were 3 million people unemployed in this country. You're all just saying that they wouldn't want to... You should have got like Norman Tebbit and got on their bike.
Strangely, I am a Labourite, and it's one of the few things Norman Tebbit did say, which I agreed with, because I've worked in the social area, and I see so many people who do not want to work.
So you're really saying that all unemployment, all people
no,
who end up unemployed...
No,
well, there
no,
you are then. So it is about a bit of luck, isn't it?
You're generalising it.
No, Tim, you said...
I said some.
But, Tim, you said the only reason you and your family have never been unemployed is because you've got the right attitude. And by logical definition, if you're accepting that some people end up unemployed when they don't want to be and it's no fault of their own, then it's a bit about bad luck for them, isn't it?
That is about bad luck.
Well, there we are then.
But
so you accept my point?
I accept that point, what you're saying, but generally hard work and taking menial jobs, which I've done over the years before I had my job, I kept in employment.
All right. Tim, I'm grateful for the conversation, really, I am. And look, I agree, there is a big part that is about attitude. Of course it is. It's not all about structure. Life is about structure and agency. My problem is we talk very often about the agency in these matters and maybe not as much about the structure. Anyway, we're talking about class, and funnily enough, it's everyone's favourite subject. Let's get the latest RBC News headlines at 11:32 with Dominic Ellis.
A man's been remanded into custody after being charged with more than 50 sexual offences against his ex-wife in Swindon. Philip Young, who's 49, is accused of drugging and raping Joanne Young, who's waived her anonymity. The climate activist Greta Thunberg has been arrested in central London. Palestine Action say she was arrested at a demonstration in support of the group's protesters who are on hunger strike in prison. An attempt is being made to restore power to large parts of Ukraine after Russia carried out a massive airstrike. Three people, including a child, were killed in overnight strikes. LBC weather cloudy for large parts of the UK today. Some outbreaks of rain in the west, a high of 10 degrees.
LBC.
Say yes to summer with the biggest ever TUI sale with a My TUI account. Say yes to flexible payment options. Say yes to free kids' places, even in the school summer holidays. With so many holiday options to choose from, you pick it, we sort it. Holiday countdown started. TUI, Atoll and app to protect it. Booking T's and C's apply. Selected departures. Minimum spend applies. Subject to availability. See website for details.
Only 2 days to go until the big day. But you're busy endlessly scrolling for the gift your brother wants that no store seems to have. There's no such thing as the perfect Christmas, but there are perfect moments. This year, make the most of moments that matter with Coca-Cola, whether you're trying to track down the perfect gift or chatting with your colleagues about this year's Christmas party. Refresh your holiday spirit with Coca-Cola, the perfect drink for sharing in the moment. Coca-Cola, holidays are coming.
Look, I've never told you this, but I've always looked up to you. In fact, I used to copy your style. You've always been the cool one. Not that I'd ever actually admit that to you. So this is my way of saying, I know you'd pick something way better than me.
Gift cards are available in-store until the 24th of December and online, even on Christmas Day, because sometimes the best gift is letting them choose. This Christmas, if you can't find the words, find the gift. John Lewis.
Same.
Ho, ho, ho!
Same.
3, 2, 1, hey!
Same.
Whoa, thanks.
Same.
What does Santa call his dog?
Same. Same.
One word. Free syllables.
Same. Same.
Sorry, it's a bit dry.
New plates.
Ooh.
Treat your table to something different this Christmas. Visit your local IKEA now. IKEA, the wonderful everyday.
Leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Time is 11:34. The other component of this conversation we should get in is the generational element to class, which is increasingly paramount, I think. If you consider that a lot of class has to be about assets and about wealth, well, frankly, the chances of, if you're young these days, of becoming asset rich and becoming wealthy are so much less than they used to be. We can see that in 1995, home ownership for young adults was 60%. Now it's 40%. The average house price to earnings ratio in 1995 was 3 to 4 times average earnings. Now it's 9 to 10 times. Typical pension security. You had the fine benefit pension schemes in, say, 1995 and before. Now you don't. You have direct, weaker contribution schemes. Class is about access to economic and security and power. It is not just about wages, and not even just about culture either. Wealth, especially inherited or asset-based wealth, is generationally skewed, and that is getting worse. And just wait till AI comes along. We're seeing the huge problems in the graduate unemployment market and youth unemployment market generally now. So the sort of precarious nature, the precariat it used to be called for a little while, the precarious part of the economy, younger workers in particular working on low wages, 0 hours or, you know, reduced hours contracts, flexible contracts, no real prospect of building up wealth. That's a huge part of the class picture as well. Interesting to hear from younger people on that, 0345 60 60 973, rather than a bunch of angry, very loud people who, for some reason, when they bought a £2 million house, expect us to all feel really sorry for them. Luke is in Manchester. Luke.
Hi, Lewis, you okay?
Yeah, no, good, thank caller. You. Oh, good. Well, lovely to have you aboard.
thank you so much. I just wanted to say, I'm definitely not going to be chewing your head off like those other callers. I'm a young person as well, and I come from a working class background. My girlfriend comes from a middle class background.
Right.
And the reason why I wanted to ring in is because we talk about this a lot.
And when you say, given that we're trying to sort of define our terms here, when you say you're from a working class background and she's from a middle class background, what do you mean by that?
So this is my point, right? Culturally and economically. So my mum basically worked as a sales assistant for a whole life. She was a single mum, raised me on that, raised me not being able to do the things that I would like to do. There was no time for extracurricular activities. My girlfriend, her mum's like a very high band nurse. Her dad was a pilot. So they come from economically a more prosperous background, but also there was time for her to develop. They pushed education, they pushed her arts, they pushed a mindset that enabled her to grow in a way that I wasn't given as a child. And I don't think that's the fault of my parents.
No.
I think it's just intrinsically tied to culture.
Yeah.
When you're working class, for example, in college, I always wanted to go to university. I did go to university, but I failed my A-levels. And when I failed my A-levels, my mum said, right, that's it now. You get a job. You get a job in a shop. And that would have been my life. But I was like, no, I want to go to university. So I did a BTEC, went to university. But it doesn't stop there, Lewis, because I didn't even know that Russell Group universities existed, because my parents didn't know that it existed.
Oh, no, I had a very similar experience myself, yeah.
Crazy bands. Yeah, exactly. I didn't know that how universities ranged. My girlfriend, she went to a grammar school in Birmingham that her parents took her to tuition to every day when she was a child because they saw the value in education. And I think that's the difference in class. It's not just about money.
Well, there's that famous...
It's about how you were raised.
There's that famous study, isn't there, Luke, which said, I think it's from the 90s, it said that children from professional families heard 2,150 words an hour on average. Children from working-class families heard 1,200 words an hour, and children from families on welfare only heard 616. So when extrapolated for the first 3 to 4 years of life, the difference was... A professional family child heard 45 million words, working class 26 million, and welfare kids 13 million. So a 30 million word gap between the highest and lowest ages, age groups by age 3 or 4. And that's massive, right? So much of this stuff gets embedded so early doors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for me, 6 million of those words would have been swear words. So it's really cutting the gap.
Hey, you should have come around my house. This is my dad. You know, it would be even worse.
No, honestly, that was just the point I wanted to make. I think some of the callers are kind of getting way off the topic that you wanted to talk about. I'm not sure why.
When you do this stuff, I find it very interesting how defensive people get. And I can sort of understand it, but I also think just sometimes setting out the facts about wealth inequality, about the fact that I've got a message here from someone, you know, when I brought up the generational point. I mean, this winds me up, this stuff, right? You get someone saying, oh, stop it, Lewis, the younger are hard done by, they've never been so well off. They've got all their cars bought for them. Get over it. What are you talking about? Like, are these people, I don't know what planet they're on. Like, the idea, by any empirical study, you would have to genuinely be brain dead to believe that the young are better off today than they used to be. By any economic metric whatsoever, everyone knows that's untrue. But people, because they like to tell themselves that they have had the hardest luck story of anybody who's ever lived on the planet, can't bear it to penetrate their sort of thick skulls, you know, and I can't get my head around it.
Yeah, I think it's what you're saying is so important, because it's really kind of opening up to me how I view class. And when I go to have kids with my girlfriend, it's so different, because she's talking about raising them in a certain way that I was never given. And it kind of scares me, because when you're brought up in a kind of survivalist mentality where everything's just about expediency and, you know, you need to get money through the door now, there's no way to develop, it skews your brain. And I need to kind of unlock that for my kids, because I want them to have the best life possible. Luckily for myself now, in terms of money-wise, I'm earning a middle-class wage with prospects to earn more. So that is going to be tied to the class system as well when I have my child. More money means more opportunity for them to grow.
Yeah.
But in terms of how emotionally I treat them as well, I feel like a lot of working-class parents don't have the time to emotionally support their children in the way that people with more affluence do. So it's that kind of dynamic as well that I'm thinking, gosh,
it's everywhere.
I might have to really, really consider this.
Luke, grateful to you. Luke in Manchester there. Although we should say, of course, that there's certainly no monopoly on being brought up well in any class. And there are plenty of middle-class people who are brought up very badly by their parents. Plenty of working-class people, myself included, who are brought up, like to think, very well. A little bit of news as well, a bit more breaking news, which is, looks like Keir Starmer has U-turned again. PM today moving to water down Labour's inheritance tax changes on farmers and farming estates amid widespread rural anger. We were hearing about that just a few minutes ago, weren't we? Under the original plan unveiled by the Chancellor in the 2024 budget, farmers face paying inheritance tax at a 20% rate on agricultural property and land worth than more than 1 million from April. You'll remember that's triggered endless protests down Whitehall, large numbers of tractors being led by, among others, Jeremy Clarkson. The Department for the Environment has just released new plans that are lifting that threshold to 2.5 million, admitting that it had acted after it had listened to concerns of the farming community. That comes exactly a week after the Prime Minister said the reforms in their original proposals were sensible. So we'll keep an eye on that and see if there's any more reaction to it. But again, so changes on inheritance tax, which is very germane to what we're talking about. John is in Bromley. John, good morning.
Good morning there. Hi, Lewis.
Hello.
Hello. I'm not sure where to start, but I kind of think I fit the profile of the kind of the situation you've raised there in that. I mean, if I start back with my parents, they came to this country, you know, kind of in the 60s. My grandparents, Eastern Europeans, and barely literate. Fast forward to today, where I've come from kind of being peasant class to growing up very working class to being in a middle class kind of lifestyle.
Nice to hear peasant. We don't hear that very often these days, John. Well, so I know what you're getting at. Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, I frequently refer to in a negative context. Yes. But when you look at it, that's exactly what they were.
Yes.
And in a very positive way. But so I'm kind of, I suppose the point I'm trying to say is that we kind of grow up in this kind of almost this American dream style society where you have to empire build.
Yeah.
And we are kind of, I've built that empire now. Both me and my wife have kind of built that empire up. So we have all the trappings of, you know, kind of quote unquote success and all these things, but there is no inherited wealth there. There is no, you know, kind of depth of wealth. So, like you say, I'm just literally one recession away from redundancy, and that all could kind of, it's like a house of cards.
Trying to get back to the where we sort of started, John, because I think in a way, partly, you know, it's inevitable, really, because you get down the sort of rabbit hole of money and wealth, and I think that is really important. But is class about more than the money and wealth? Is it about culture?
So I guess I suppose it's kind of turned up, it's kind of like turned on its head now, because growing up, you know, I'm the same age as kind of James O'Brien, and he raised this kind of point a few weeks ago. You know, I grew up in a working class environment, and again, you know, with parents who didn't, whose first language wasn't English. And so it was very much his, you kind of stay in your lane. But as I suppose the economy has developed all of a sudden, and what does class mean now? It doesn't mean that you can be, you know, kind of like migrate literally from working class to middle class and so on. But 50 years ago, you know, kind of, or when it, you know, 20, 30 years ago, you, if you were born working class, you had a certain job, you went to a certain school.
But well, it was easier, wasn't it, John? It was easier. I mean, as a sort of economic classification, it was just easier, basically. And this is, even then, this was a bit crude, but I think, you know, it still sort of worked. If we go back to the economy of the 1940s or 50s, say, you either sort of worked with your hands or you didn't. And if you didn't work with your hands and you were therefore professional, you were likely middle class. And if you worked with your hands or you were working in some sort of manual occupation, you were more or less working class. And that's translation, that ease, translated into politics as well, because the former overwhelmingly voted Conservative and the latter overwhelmingly voted Labour. But now we have all of the, it's so much more fragmented and complicated now because there's so many extra divisions. I've mentioned wealth, I've mentioned income, but there's also educational divides, educational class differences, whether you went to a university or not, cultural ones and generational ones as well, which I think are important.
Yeah. And I'm all for, kind of opportunity. So, you know, as much as I want to kind of work hard and earn, you know, kind of, and get wealthy, et cetera, I also, you know, I want my taxes to be, I'm not saying this to be sound trite, but I want my taxes to be spent to give people opportunity rather, and so I'm happy to be taxed, you know, and hopefully I'll be able to inherit some wealth that my parents have built up by your earlier point, which is just by virtue of just living somewhere all their lives. And a chunk of it goes to the government. I'm more than happy for that to happen. I suppose, so I don't want to necessarily kind of get away with it. Say, okay, we've built up this empire. Now don't touch it.
Yeah.
I'm saying is, you know, enjoy some of it, but some of it also is, like you said, kind of, you know, it's unearned wealth. So I can't expect, got to be kind of reasonable expectations. And I think, if, you know, health is wealth is the most important thing. And you can be, you know, kind of on a lower income and be unhealthy. And you can also be on a earning fantastic, you know, kind of eye-watering amounts. But are you happy? Does it make you happy? There's no guarantee. And so that's why I frequently pinch myself with what I do have.
John, John and Bromley, I'm grateful to you. Got to go to the break now, but I think it's a really important contribution. And look, I think that thing that John just said there is really important as well about tax, which is, look, no one likes paying tax. And I think it's certainly true to say that the British state is probably taxing too much and in an unreformed way, spending it too often on the wrong things. I think it's taxing, as I've said many times on this station and elsewhere, I think it taxes too much in income, doesn't tax enough in wealth. But when your tax goes out, when my tax goes out at the end of the month or whatever it happens to be, you do know that, you know, you think back to your own childhood, right? And yeah, I wouldn't be where I am now if I hadn't gone to, you know, a good school, like was a, you know, state school, primary school, whatever, funded by the taxpayer, funded by the state, giving you that chance in life. So there are other working class kids there in exactly the same situation. All those little schemes, gifted and talented money, you name it. So sometimes, yes, no one likes paying tax, but there is a reason for it. And we probably focus too much on the negative and not enough on the positive. It's class, though, more than just about money. Can you be £80,000, £100,000, £200,000, still say that you're working class? Can I still say, with any justification, that I'm working class, as I could pretty much for the first 18, 25, I don't know, years of my life? 0345 6060973. The time is 11:49.
LBC.
Calling all young creatives. It's time to get prepped for the art and design industry. And where better than Global Academy? Here's Keo, an art and design student in year 12.
As an art student, we get the chance to work on our own pieces, either in the studio or using the digital software. Some of my work has also been shown in galleries. And last week, I got the chance to attend a design agency to learn more about my future career.
Global Academy. Apply now and join us in years 10 or 12. GlobalAcademy.com.
New year, new you. Maybe. New year, new car, definitely. Upgrade your year with a new Vauxhall Fonterra Electric or any car from our award-winning range. With 0% APR over 4 years with a minimum 20% deposit and £1,000 off on top of all other offers. That's a resolution worth sticking to. Search Vauxhall today. £1,000 saving on new car orders until the January 2026. Personal contract purchase, 20% deposit, 18+. Subject to status and availability. T's and C's, Stellantis Financial Services.
When you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you.
Life feels better with a smile. Fanning Dental Group Clinics. Modern, comfortable and affordable dentistry for all. See online for our price match promise. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling and the whole world smiles with you.
FanningDental.co.uk.
This Christmas Eve, the £50 million Lotto jackpot must be won.
Must be won.
Must be won.
Must be won.
Yes, the £50 million Lotto jackpot must be won on Christmas Eve. There's magic in the air, so get your ticket today. Lotto from the National Lottery. It could be you. Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Serious about the right vitamins for you and your family? Trust Vitabiotics, the UK's number one vitamin company for expert nutritional care for every age and lifestyle. Vitamins for everyone, including well man, well woman, well baby and well kid. From Boots, pharmacies and Vitabiotics.com. For number one verification, see Vitabiotics.com.
This Christmas, McDonald's and the Elf on the Shelf are bringing festive tasks to your little ones, like writing a Christmas card for your postie.
Thank you. You're one happy helper.
Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 30th of December, from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy while stocks last. Subject to availability, fair ordering policy applies.
This is LBC with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 11:51. A few of your texts. Chris says, "Hi Lewis, I don't think class has much to do with wealth or income. It's more a state of mind, attitude, behaviour, accent, education. Plenty of people are poor, but still middle class. And we've all met people who, even though they've made loads of money, can't shake off their humble beginnings. And it shows." It's interesting that, though, Dave, that's quite a different attitude to, say, the Americans. The Americans have a much more classic kind of wealth and income version of class. That's why their middle class is so vast by comparison. Most Americans would refer to themselves as middle class, working class, really closer to probably what we would call sort of underclass in this country or something close to it. And then there's a sort of super rich, and most aspire to be in a category higher than the one that they are. It's in Britain, where class has associations of culture and bourgeois. I mean, obviously, there will be a bit of that everywhere, but, you know, as you say there, you're sort of implying that someone who's maybe a billionaire is still on some level working class because of their accent, which probably wouldn't be the case in certain other countries. Eleanor says, if middle-incomers need to claim working class as a title, I get why, then we need to start seriously using the qualifying lower working class and destitute, because that would be a real reflection of life in the UK. I think, yes, precariat, Eleanor, I think is a good way of saying that. And for Lewis Goodall, thank you for using my full name, Blake, genuine question, Lewis, opposed to an ungenuine one. Why does it seem like everyone on your programme is fighting to be classed as working class? Many parents want a better life for their children. The whole point is to raise your children into a better social and economic situation than when you were a kid, not to keep them working class. Love the show. I think it's an interesting question, Blake, and I think it comes back to this thing about why older people often insist that they had it harder than younger people. I think none of us like to accept that in whatever way we were lucky and in whatever way that we had it easier than other people. We all have to convince ourselves that we're the sort of main characters in the story and that we've overcome things that others have not. And I think for whatever reason, maybe it's a slightly British thing of not wanting to show off as well. There's an element of almost just wanting to sort of put down your own achievements, even. Maybe it's a sort of slightly self-effacing thing. I don't know. But it is striking, because as I say, I don't think it would take place in the United States. Rhys is in Dagenham. Rhys, good morning.
Hiya. I rang in to share, like, my upbringing, because I feel like many other people, I sort of fall through the gaps in sort of class debate. My parents are working class. My dad is a cab driver. But growing up, I had, I would say, like a typical sort of middle class upbringing. I went to private school. I had lots of opportunities that you would typically associate with maybe certain classes that others might not have as often. And where do I stand? But then also, my family are immigrants. We came to this country from Pakistan. And I think, you know, earlier on in this discussion, you were saying that there was that this is a generation where we have a worse set of living standards compared to our like previous generation. I don't think that applies to most immigrants. I feel like whatever life I've had growing up is definitely better than what my parents had when they were in Pakistan.
Yeah.
An example of like how I sort of slipped through the cracks is, like now today, I work in a job. I'm a software developer. I make like a sort of middle class salary, but I always do feel working class, like to some extent. I'm not sure if that's because I want to just recognise my mum's sort of work, or if it's maybe the thing that you're alluding to of trying to not show off too much. What do you think?
It's an interesting, Rhys. I'm really glad you said that. I hadn't actually thought about that before. That there's an element of like, I've sort of, the way I got to this subject is sort of by asking myself, why does it rankle with me when someone calls me middle class now? Even though, I get it. I can be objective enough to sort of say, yeah, I can see why there's a perfectly credible explanation for that. And even maybe quite insulting to, you know, actually people in working class occupations, in working class jobs to sort of, for me to say, oh, I'm just the same as you. So I totally get it. I think you're right. There's probably a component, a strain, which is almost like, yeah, it almost feels slightly disrespectful to my family members who have come before, right? You kind of want to slightly kind of honour that and know it and feel that lineage and that pedigree to say, you know, I'm from them, and whatever I've got now, it's they didn't have it. Do you know what I mean? But you're right. Maybe it's partly that.
Yeah, and I feel like when I was younger and I was definitely more working class, there were lots of middle class things that I felt weren't accessible to me.
Yes.
But actually, I think everything's pretty, like, for example, I mean, it's not kind of a very small example. I like to play golf. I like to go to the driving range. And I always thought that's kind of a posh thing to do. If you go to a driving range, a bucket of golf balls costs like £8. It's not expensive. Anyone can go. It's not like inaccessible. I always end up enrolling in kind of private courses and things. And I do like horse riding and stuff. And okay, maybe it's like you need disposable income, but nothing that like I've like done particularly is completely out of the realms of working class people. I feel like,
yes,
especially nowadays, everything just is open to everybody. So it maybe is becoming more of like a mindset culture thing.
And this is one of the things I hate. You reminded me of two things. One of the things I absolutely hate, is the way that when working class people are successful, and they are still identifiably in whatever way working class, whether it's their accent or whatever it is, the whole like you know, basically like nothing too good for the workers. You know, the best example is Angela Rayner. You know, when she went to the opera or when she did anything that kind of could be construed as a middle class thing, you know, the papers would come for her and imply somehow that she was like betraying her own class or betraying where she comes from, or she wasn't authentically working class because she was doing these nice things. I mean, how absolutely outrageous, you know, the idea that somehow working class people can't be allowed to enjoy or to have nice things. It's just mind-boggling. Reese in Dagenham, grateful to you. Reminds me of the other thing that always winds me up, or actually always interesting, which is actually like there's this weird thing, I think, if you've gone from one class to the other, which I think I probably have, you know, in all reality, like when I'm with sort of my really middle-class people, it's very tempting to sort of play the working class oik, quote-unquote, so to speak, a little bit. So much so that when I was at Oxford, I was actually described by one girl there as the college's bit of rough, which is the only time anybody has ever said that to me, and I fear it's the only time that anybody ever will. Let's talk to Rob, who's in Maidstone. Rob.
Hiya, Lewis. So I think, having listened to all your callers, one of the things that we don't talk about is that income is not the definer. It's what wealth allows over time. Because what the middle class get that the working class doesn't is the time to make longer term decisions and choices that are not available to working class people.
Yes, because what wealth provides and what security provides is the ability to do something which is beyond just day to day or week to week survival. It allows you to plan. It allows you to make decisions you wouldn't otherwise be able to make, which in turn basically embeds your wealth, and it's a sort of virtuous circle, and you end up in a better position.
Yeah, because Lewis, you can be absolutely working class, okay? But I don't know if you have children, but when you have children, the chances are that your children will actually be middle class.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, 100%.
Because you would have acquired a professional status.
Yes.
You would have acquired maybe a home, you would have pensions, so that you have the knowledge that whatever happens to you, your children will have a financial stability that you and your family didn't have.
And social, and not just capital, Rob, but social capital. You know, contacts.
Well, when I talk about capital, awareness, I'm talking about that as
sure.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, social capital in terms of people you know and contacts, and but also just exposure to worlds that you would never even have been aware of, right? Just even the idea of higher education just being normalized or whatever it happens to be, you know, travel, all this sort of stuff. That is, as you say, it's kind of the room to breathe in life.
And I had to think about it. One of my great uncles built the Green Goddess lorries his entire life.
Really?
And was an absolute...
Still in service, of course. God bless him.
Absolute opera nut. I can remember he had a set of 7 albums of all the great arias, and the greatest thing he ever wanted to do was actually be able to go to the opera. So what he did with his daughter is he wanted his daughter to have an education he didn't have, because he had to leave school at 14. He wanted her to have the opportunity to choose which path she would go down. And we completely underestimate this, and I thought it was over. And a few years ago, I worked as a facilitator with a youth group, and I watched a lad who had been offered an apprenticeship at the BBC, and his parents said, that's not for people like us, because you need to be earning a proper salary when you get your first job. And I realized, for a middle-class family, it would have been great, go, because the long-term effect of you taking that short-term hit in terms of your money is that you will have a profession going forward.
Exactly.
I think the difference. So when you had that lady shouting at you earlier,
yes,
absolutely true. The parents of that couple were absolutely working class, with a set of aspirations and choices they made so that their children would have a far better set of choices when they became parents.
Yes. Rob, I think you have absolutely crystallized, in a way, no one else has done, myself included, in the last hour, exactly the crux of this matter. In a way, class, what it really is about, it's about freedom. It's about freedom to be able to live the life that you want to live. And the higher up the social hierarchy, the economic hierarchy, you go, and whether that's about the choices that have been framed inside your head when you were a baby, the horizons as a young child or whatever it is that are given to you on the basis of your class, or whether it's about your financial freedom, the economic status that you have. It's basically about being able to live the life that you want to live. It's about freedom. And working class people and people, you know, lower middle class people, lower working class people, people in the precariat or whatever, have less and less and less freedom, fewer and fewer and fewer choices. And actually, funnily enough, that biggest choice of all, even to have a family, is what we're going to talk about next. The time is 12:02.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, some breaking news this hour. The government has announced it's to raise the inheritance tax relief threshold for farmers. It's to increase to 2.5 million from a proposed 1 million from next April. It's a major U-turn by ministers and follows months of pressure and demonstrations on the issue. We'll bring you more on this story throughout the afternoon here on LBC. A man's been remanded into custody after being charged with more than 50 sexual offences against his ex-wife, Philip Young, who's 49, is accused of drugging and raping Joanne Young over a period of 13 years. Five other men have been charged with sexual offences against Miss Young, who's waived her right to anonymity. LBC's reporter Thea Rickard has more details from Swindon Magistrates Court.
Philip Young spoke only to confirm his name, date of birth and address here at Swindon Magistrates Court today, as he stood charged with 56 offences, including multiple counts of rape and administering a substance with intent to stupefy his ex-wife, Joanne Young.
The climate activist Greta Thunberg has been arrested in central London. Palestine Action says she was detained at a demonstration in support of the group's protesters on hunger strike in prison. Police say she was detained for displaying a placard in support of a proscribed terror organisation. Attempts are being made to restore power to large parts of Ukraine after Russia carried out a massive overnight attack. Three people, including a child, were killed in the drone and missile strikes. It's understood Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor has had his gun licence revoked. It follows a security review with specialist police officers last month. It's not clear why the decision has been taken, but it means Andrew can only use or transport his guns if accompanied. The former prince is expected to move from his Royal Lodge residence in Windsor in the new year. And the Met Office says 2025 is on course to be the hottest year ever recorded in the UK. Experts say the average annual temperature is currently well ahead the previous record set in 2022. A cooler Christmas could affect the figures, though. Amy Doherty is from the Met Office.
What's perhaps a warm year at the moment or 10 years ago will become normal in the future. And what that will mean is we'll see more droughts, we'll see more heat waves and potentially more wildfires unless we adapt against them.
In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down a point at 98.64. The pound buys $1.35 and a euro 14. LBC weather. Cloudy for large parts of the UK going into the afternoon. Some outbreaks of rain in the west with a high of 10 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Hey, Harry.
Hello, mate.
Got any tips?
Your best bet is to play BetVictor's daily free-to-play guaranteed prize wheel.
What guaranteed prizes does this guaranteed prize wheel guarantee?
The guaranteed prize wheel means you're guaranteed to win prizes, like free bets, free spins, exclusive offers and cash. Guaranteed.
What was it called again?
The guaranteed prize wheel.
Well, I guarantee I'll give it a spin.
And I guarantee you'll win a prize.
Listen to Harry and make your best bet on BetVictor's guaranteed prize wheel. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. Opt in and spin the wheel. Rewards expire 24 hours after claiming. Gambleaware.org.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 12:06. Well, we finished the last hour by talking about the idea that class, or one definition of class, and I think it's one that appeals to me at least, is about freedom. And it is about the freedom to make choices about your own lives. And there is an intriguing sort of subplot to that, not least with the generational element that we were talking about as well. The idea that some generations are facing the prospect of not being able to do things that previous generations may have taken for granted. The most obvious example being the ability, with some ease, it's always going to be a little bit difficult, but, you know, with a relative amount of ease, something that should certainly not feel unobtainable, in buying a house. Might that even come to include, or is already including, starting a family? Or is it that younger people are exercising their freedom in that they just don't want to start a family? This comes off the back of an interesting piece in the Times by the former director of the IFS, Paul Johnson, in which his title is "The UK Prepared for a Plunging Birth Rate and Therefore Net Emigration? We're already seeing schools struggling to attract enough children, but the consequences are a lot more serious than that." This refers to Britain's collapse in fertility rate, well known, as Paul Johnson says, but largely unanticipated, at least in terms of the speed. Fertility rates, as in babies per woman, peaked at about 1.9 children per woman in 2010, not so long ago. By 2016, that had fallen slightly to 1.8 children per woman, and the Office for National Statistics was predicting they would recover a bit, not fall, recover a bit from there. In fact, by 2018, fertility rates had declined to a bit under 1.7. The ONS again expected a slow recovery. By 2020, that had slowed to 1.5. By 2022, it was 1.4. In each case, the ONS has predicted stabilisation and eventual recovery. So far, it hasn't happened. It could fall even further. Now, we've had swings in fertility rates before, but this is a whole new thing, because a fertility rate of 1.4, as Paul Johnson says, implies a rapidly falling population. You need, I think the replacement rate is 2.1, in order to just keep the population at a same steady level. But this is happening, and it is happening rapidly. There is a demographic time bomb which could potentially go off. And we've seen this happen in other countries around the world before now. Japan, for example, it was only a few years ago that adult nappies started to be outsold, or started to outsell nappies for babies in Japan. There are whole villages and towns in Japan which are basically ghostly, where no one lives anymore because the population has fallen too rapidly. Italy and a few other countries as well have been ahead of us on the population decline for some time. The UK, buttressed by pretty robust immigration figures, among other things, has largely avoided some of the worst of those excesses. But very, very quickly, we can see that despite the fact that our population is still projected to grow by to 72.5 million by 2032, primarily due to immigration, we see a rapid trend towards ageing. Over 65s are expected to make up near a much larger share of the population each and every decade, perhaps even up to 27% over 65s by the 2070s. Bear in mind that at the turn of the 20th century, less than 1% of the British population was over the age of 80. We are seeing a transformation in the demographics in a way that we have never seen before over human history. And it begs the question, why? Is it about economics? Is it about housing? Is it about people feeling they can't have children until much later in life, by which time sometimes it is too late, or it is too late to have the bigger family that they may have wanted? Or is it about women in particular, but young couples and couples generally, simply for whatever reason, not wanting to have families in the way that they previously had? I.e., is it about something that is being imposed upon them, a lack of freedom, or is it about more freedom than ever before? And if that is you, why are you choosing not to have either more children or any children at all? 0345 6060973. 0345 6060973. This is one of those stories that is a bit like climate change in a way. It is a slow burn thing. It's happening slowly, happening before our eyes, but it's potentially transformative. Let's talk now to Sam Friedman, who's a senior fellow at the Institute for Government, the IFG. His Substack, of course, is an excellent Substack. I think still the most popular political Substack in the UK. It's called Comment is Freed. Sam, it is a big change, this, isn't it? It's happening relatively quickly.
It is, and it's happening quicker than anybody expected, and it's having real policy consequences already. We're seeing schools closing in London, primary schools closing in London and in big cities as a result, and it will continue to have a big effect over the coming years.
What do we know, if anything, at the moment, about the causes for it?
There's a few different things going on. I mean, part of it is cost of living and money and the difficulty of people being able to afford to have children. But we're also seeing other demographic trends. This is happening all over the world, as you said. People are meeting their partners much later in life, which is having an effect. When we ask people how many children they would like to have, they still say they would like to have as many as they did in the past.
Mm.
But they're giving themselves much less time in which to have them, and also have fewer resources with which to do so. It seems really immune to any policy change. You know, you've had countries like France, like Hungary, that have spent quite a lot of money trying to boost their fertility rate, but aren't doing any better than we are. So it is a real challenge, and it is happening everywhere. So it can't be something specific to the UK. It's trends that are global.
I mean, this is a thing that's really interesting to me, Sam, because obviously one of the answers to this is often put forward is to try to move, for example, particularly to focus policy on women, in making women's lives, which have obviously become much more complicated than they were in the past, when women were primarily still in the sort of domestic sphere, now expected, not just expected, but largely required due to cost of living pressures, to have a full-time job, still bring up a family, mm-hmm. and so on. So one idea, which is perfectly logical, is to, as you say, change policy to focus particularly on allowing women to, you know, have that professional life and also have those children. So obviously childcare being the most obvious example. There are lots of countries around Europe which have invested a lot of money in that, and have it as part of their sort of everyday existence, the Nordic countries in particular. All of that worth doing, by the way. But the evidence suggests it isn't actually does that much in terms of boosting birth rates.
Yeah, it might help at the margins. It might help a little bit. Nordic countries do still have better birth rates than, say, Italy or Spain or us. But it doesn't seem to stop the decline. All of those countries are still seeing a very substantial decline, as we are, in fertility rates. And part of that has got to be just, as I say, the choices people are making, both intentional, deciding not to have children for financial reasons or just because they don't want them, and unintentional, in the sense of just finding their partner later in life and not having the time to have children. I think people, when they're younger, probably underestimate how difficult it is to have children once you reach a certain age. And those trends are all part of it too.
I mean, structurally as well. I mean, you can see, even for families who might like to have children earlier in life, the truth is that we do have a sort of longer adolescence, right, in all sorts of different ways. People we know from all of the statistics are living at home for longer, often because they're compelled to do so, either because they can't afford rent or they might want to save for a house. You know, wages, real wages for younger people haven't shifted all that much. They've been some of the biggest lagging indicators in terms of the economy as well. And, you know, in that situation, it is very hard to see how, you know, starting a family when it takes so much longer to sort of get a foothold and start going up the ladder of economic life, it's sort of easy to see how that is all deferred.
Yeah, absolutely. Housing costs have probably been one of the biggest structural changes, not just in this country, but in other developed countries around the world. And you are seeing more and more people living at home up through their 20s and into their 30s, and that's inevitably going to inhibit opportunities to raise a family. The number of people who own their own homes in their 20s and 30s has shrunk hugely over the last 20 years.
What do you say? I'm already seeing a few texts, Sam, coming in a similar vein, and I'll just pick one. But there are others that are similar. They say, "Hi, Lewis, thank God for this news. We don't need any more houses. No schools, new schools are needed. No more hospitals are needed. We need to stop overpopulation. It's good that the global population declines. The truth is that climate change is going to destroy everything," and so on. So this is the idea that actually depopulation, because obviously the global economy population has expanded enormously over the course of the last century, and has continued to do so for a while longer, but the depopulation is a good thing.
Yeah, it's not, because it means that if you imagine the population falling over time, that doesn't mean you have the same demographic as you do now. It just means you have a lot of old people who obviously struggle to look after themselves, who need pensions, who need money for social care, and there's no one to provide that support, either within their own family or the financial support via taxes. So you end up with this very top-heavy populations that we're not going to be able to afford. So whilst I think it's a reasonable argument to say we wouldn't want the global population to keep increasing at a massive rate forever, depopulation is going to lead to huge problems, social problems, economic problems. We're already starting to see that in the extent to which health spending and pension spending is an increasing part of our budget in the UK.
It also I mean, I've thought about this a lot, it transforms the nature of society. I mean, we've never had it before. We've never had a society in
pretty much the sum of human history, which is so weighted demographically to the old. We see the effects of that in politics, but we've not had a situation, you know, there's all sorts of potential consequences of that for the economy. There's all sorts of social consequences as well. It's happening so quickly, so rapidly, but I don't think we're quite alive to it.
Yeah, and as you said at the beginning, there are some other countries that are ahead of us on this, and we can think, you know, learn from both what they are trying to do and also from the challenges they're facing. Japan, South Korea. We need to think about how we manage an aging population without such reliance on people to look after that. And Japan has moved towards using robotics a lot more in supporting older people. So there's a lot we're going to have to change in our society. Some of it we don't know how to do yet. And another aspect of it is immigration. You know, immigration's been this huge issue in British politics now for the last few years. Concern that it's so high, it's now dropping very rapidly, and we could find ourselves in a position where we desperately need immigration in order to sustain enough population to support an aging population. And that's going to really change the dynamics of political debate, given there's been such hostility to immigration over the last decade or so.
Sam Friedman there, senior fellow at the IFG, the Institute for Government, of course, in Substack. Much recommended, his call or comment is Freed. I want to hear from you about this, of course. I mean, you were in that position. Have you thought about having a child? Did you leave it too late? Why do you think this is? And could anything help you have more children? The sort of policies which are sometimes put forward to try and encourage the birth rate. Would they work? Can they work? How do we explain this fertility crisis? 0345-6060973, 0345-6060973. Call the session. Louise, in a moment, followed by an update, as we saw, heard from in the last hour, the changes, a U-turn from the government on inheritance tax for farmers, and the latest tranche, 11,000 new documents released in the Epstein files. So lots more to come. You're listening to Lewis Goodall here on LBC. The time is 12:18.
LBC.
The Lotto £15 million jackpot must be won tomorrow.
You heard that right. Lotto's £15 million jackpot must be won.
Must be won?
Exactly. Must be won.
And very exciting news, it could be you.
Me?
Yup. As long as you have a ticket, you're in with a chance.
Well then, I'd best grab a ticket.
Lotto's £15 million jackpot must be won on Christmas Eve, or thousands of you will win a share of the prize. Get your ticket today. Lotto from the National Lottery. It could be you. Prizes rounded down to the nearest pound. Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Only 2 days to go until the big day, but you're still running around stores looking for that top that Nan has at the top of her wish list. There's no such thing as the perfect Christmas, but there are perfect moments. This year, make the most of moments that matter with Coca-Cola, whether you're trying to track down the perfect gift or chatting with your colleagues about this year's Christmas party. Refresh your holiday spirit with Coca-Cola, the perfect drink for sharing in the moment. Coca-Cola. Holidays are coming.
You know how fans shout at football matches?
Oh, wake up!
That's because sound is the most effective way to tell the players they're rubbish. Works in advertising too. Because when you amplify your advertising using radio, your campaign is 49% more likely to get noticed. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
This is LBC with Lewis Goodall. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Time is 12:20. Just a reminder, you know, if you go back to 1940, the median age in this country, so the middle age, the average person was 34. By the end of this decade, it's projected to be 44. So that's a 10-year increase in what? 80 years. Again, stuff like this has just never happened before. For most of human history, it's sort of hard to get our head around. For most of human history, there just weren't many old people for obvious reasons. It is a great problem to have that there are going to be so many old people, but it is also does pose challenges that we need to talk about, particularly if we're not replacing them with enough young people, which is precisely the policy nightmare that we're getting into. Sasha is in Stevenage, who I think has something to say about this. Sasha, afternoon.
Hi, Lewis.
Hi. So what's your thoughts? Why are we not having enough babies?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? I'm within, like, the target demographic of people that would have had kids
15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I think it's a mixture of reasons. I'm 28 years old, and I recently moved back in with my parents after living away for 10 years, going to uni, settling in Bristol, and I've come back to try and save money for a house. But to be completely honest, after a year of that, I'm now tempted to go travelling. And I think this kind of feeds in with what you were saying about the extended adolescence. Mm. There's definitely, I feel like an adult, but I also don't feel as much of an adult as I'd say my parents would have been at my age. So by my age, they had two kids. They had me at age 4 and they had my brother at age 10.
Absolutely terrifyingly, Sasha. When I think about that, when my mum was my age now, I'm 36, I was 18. So she was done with me.
You were at the house.
I was done, yeah.
And do you have kids? You don't?
No, no. So exactly, I'm exactly embodied the transformation that's happened. Like, literally at my mum's age, she had literally brought me up and that was it. I was at university and I haven't even started.
Yeah, I don't know if you have the same experience of your parents telling you about what it was like raising you, but I know there was more housing support. It was a comfortable life. It was appealing to settle down. There weren't any kind of obstacles in the way. And I feel like that's completely flipped on its head.
I think two things have happened, haven't they? It feels to me, I think it has both been harder to get that life if you want it because of housing and job insecurity and lots of other stuff. But it's also true to say that the opportunities and horizons have expanded in some regards. And therefore, that has also become tempting. So the two things feed into each other. It's harder to achieve that slightly more settled life. And at the same time, it has been easier to have a slightly more unsettled one, which can be good and bad, which your own experience sort of epitomizes. So I suppose that's what's happening.
Yeah, it's a massive juxtaposition. You've both got more choice and less choice in one instance. The job market's pretty massive at the moment. I know for a fact, I went self-employed a year ago, and I work in marketing in the entertainment industry. So settling down in itself is kind of off the cards at the moment if I want my career to keep going. And I'm fine with that. And my friends that are in similar positions that are female also have the same viewpoint. That's not to say that we don't want to settle down. I think there's a massive issue as well with rural versus metropolitan dating styles. When I've moved back home in the last year, a lot more people that I know within the town that I live in have had kids at a younger age and have 5 to 10 year olds versus my friends who are living in cities that are the same age, if not a little bit older, and living completely different lifestyles.
So here's a question for you, Sasha, right? Let's just imagine there was a world where you could have had that life more easily if you'd wanted it. Or you could have the life you have now. What would you have chosen?
The life I have now. Yeah. I feel like I've got
more freedom.
Yeah, exactly that. I've set myself up really well. I'm proud of where I'm at in life. I've got a wicked support network. That's not to say that I don't want to have kids. I don't want to have a family. But it's not. It doesn't feel like a be all end all to me. I'm enjoying the journey that I'm on.
Yeah. And if you got to, by the time you did settle down, because I think this does happen to a lot of women in particular, but also men, if you got to the sort of time when you sort of settled down, but it was a bit later on and it proved difficult or impossible to have children, would that be a source of endless regret, or would you just accept that as the sort of compromise that you'd made?
I guess you don't know until you get there, do
you? I suppose that's true. Yeah, you don't know.
I could get there also and then decide, no, I don't actually want to have kids and do a little bit of a Carrie Bradshaw. I think.
Yeah, and what I think is potentially a bit regressive or dangerous about this conversation, not this conversation, but I think we are heading to a world where this birth rate thing does become a bigger political conversation. And what I think would be potentially dangerous to happen is that somehow we end up in a kind of world where, the politics, which I can completely imagine, would basically be a kind of young women in particular, and it will be women, are selfish and they should stop, having the freedom and having the careers and all that sort of stuff, and they need to focus on family, which would be very regressive. And I completely see that politics emerging.
It's funny though, isn't it? Because go back to the 60s and there was a big push to get women into work.
Yes.
And it's the demands of society at the time. But I think one productive thing that we could do that I've done with friends that are a bit older than me is look into treatments that we can use or fertility planning. Mm. Okay, you're at this point in your life, you're 28 years old, you don't see any potential for a partner or a family on the horizon, but you know that you want to have kids. Mm. Easier options.
Yes. Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting point. Sasha in Stevenage, I think, has absolutely epitomised the kind of dilemma and the kind of, I think she summed it up so well, both sort of the freedom and unfreedom which exists at the same time, and the duality of that. Both things can be true. Louise is in Shotts in Lanarkshire, in the central part of Scotland. Louise, good afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon, Lewis. Thanks for taking my call.
Not at all.
Listen, I know that this is a conversation, but just I've got a few quick points
Please.
I'd like to make, and then, you know, we can delve into Yes. it afterwards, right? So this is proper quick fire. Number one, not exclusively, but the vast majority of people whining on about the falling birth rate tend to be men.
Yes.
And it tend to be men that either don't have any or not the target number of kids.
Yes.
Secondly, there's now roughly an equal number of men and women that are choosing not to have kids.
Yes.
Because it's no longer the taboo that it once was.
Yes.
Thirdly, society is changing and we're going to have to deal with it. You know, we're not in the era of 2.4 kids anymore. I'm 41 soon and, you know, I'm kind of reconciling to myself that, you know, there won't be any state pension, especially with the economy is going at the moment. Fourthly, right, imagine saying to your child, you know, if you brought your kid into the world, oh, hi, little Harry, or whatever you want to call the baby. You know, hey, so we brought you into the world, A, because we love you, but B, because we need you to be a taxpayer in the future. So that's not very comforting or kind.
Yes.
Right? And then
we had to look after the population pyramid. That's what we had to do.
No, but here's the thing, and here is my fifth and final point. Like, we can throw, or the government can choose to throw a load of money, right, at policies for women. Like, you have a look at what they're doing in Russia and America, and they're trying to pay women to have kids,
yes.
right? But there was a debate on LBC a couple of weeks ago that 100,000 16 to 30-year-olds have left the UK because they don't see a future here, right? So there's no guarantee that, you know, as a nation, if we pop out, like, a whole load of kids, that they're going to stay in the country. And it's just honestly wild.
So do you think that, a bit as I was sort of getting to with Sasha at the end, do you think that there's a sort of danger that this becomes a sort of woman problem that we need, that women are sort of expected to solve?
Okay, so it's only a problem, right, if society doesn't change. And I
yes.
think that, you know, so like your previous contributor, I think it was Sam Friedman, right, was like, oh, you know, like there are like other countries around the world. So you take a look at Japan, right, which I'm guessing is one of the countries he was alluding to.
Well, they've got birth rate less than one, I think, now, which is pretty extraordinary.
Well, it might be extraordinary, but that's just the way society and human civilization's gone, because the same's happening in America. Mm. But you could take a look at it's a very broad brushstroke statement, but any kind of Western developed nation, and women, men as well, people are choosing not to have as many kids. And the governments are stuck thinking, well, we need like the 2.4 kids. And I'm sorry, but, you know, the world has moved on from that.
Yeah, I get it. I suppose the question is that, and the truth is, there'll be a bit of truth in both these ideas. I suppose the question is where the balance is between, as you say, people just making a free choice not to have children, which is absolutely their right, and no one can force you to have children, whether you're a man or a woman, and that is absolutely right. And that is just about your freedom and your life choices. And how much of it is about people either having no children or fewer children who would like to have children but can't do so because of structural factors beyond their control? And if it's the latter, then that's more worrying, isn't it?
Well, here's the thing, right? I mean, I was watching a thing on the news the other day there, right? And, you know, the way that have it, like, raising kids, and full disclosure, I don't have any kids, but my sister has three, right? It's a job that I could not do, because it is, like, the hardest job in the world. But yet, you know, like, the way that just society, like, you know, if you work, if you send your kids to school, I mean, like, so, like, you send your kids to school and they're off for 6 weeks over the summer, right? So even just looking at it with, like, you know, like plain eyes, having kids does not reconcile with having to work. And I'm sorry, in this current climate and economy, you need two people working as opposed to just one.
Well, I still find it amazing, Louise. I always find it amazing, you know, that, and I know parents deal with this every day of the week, but, like, you know, the fact that schools knock off at 3 o'clock, and I know there are after school clubs and things like that, but just managing those day-to-day things when, you know, you've got two parents who, usually in most parts of the country these days, have to be in some form of work. It's unlikely that you're going to have one person not in work at all who can deal with all that stuff. That's just really hard.
It is impossible, is what it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just, it's like I said before, having kids is not for the faint-hearted, especially, you know, in this day and age. But I also think as well that rather than people harping on about, you know, so how can we increase the birth rate, right? So why doesn't the government or the debate just kind of adapt to the reality as it's unfolding before us? But, you know, we're like, no. So let's go back to the 60s when, you know, the woman was at home. And you know, the average number of kids was 2.4 kids or whatever. I mean, just like the world has literally moved on, and we can't keep relying on that same structure into the future.
Louise, in short, grateful to you and grateful for your thoughts on that. As promised, we're going to be getting an update from the president of the NFU about that U-turn from the government on inheritance tax for farmers. First, though, at 12:32, let's get the latest LBC News headlines with Amelia Cox.
The government has watered down changes to inheritance tax relief for farmers following months of protests. The threshold before they have to pay anything to the government has risen from £1 million to £2.5 million. A man has been remanded in custody after being charged with drugging and raping his ex-wife. 49-year-old Philip Young is accused of offences against Joanne Young, who has waived her right to anonymity alongside five other men. And climate activist Greta Thunberg has been arrested at a demonstration held in support of members of Palestine Action on hunger strike in prison. Police say she was detained over displaying a placard in support of the group. LBC weather generally cloudy this afternoon with a few spots of light rain, brief bright spells in the west, patchy rain moving across the north, a high of 10 degrees.
This is LBC.
When you're growing a small business in your area, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. With an HSBC Small Business Banking account, you can choose from a range of business borrowing solutions to suit you and your plans. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC Small Business Banking account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Borrowing is also subject to affordability, fees, charges and rates. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
The big day is almost here, and you know what that means. Turkey. Well, not just turkey. M&S British free-range turkey crown with a pork cherry and chestnut stuffing glazed with maple syrup infused with chilli, cinnamon, clove and nutmeg. It also means Cornish cruncher cauliflower cheese with Emmental pecorino and mozzarella. And British baby parsnips with maple syrup glaze with polenta and pecorino. This is not just food. This is M&S Christmas food. Selected stores.
Have you noticed the way fans shout at football matches?
Oh, wake up!
That's because conveying your message with sound is the most effective way to communicate to the players on the pitch that they're rubbish. And this works in advertising too. You see, research shows how brands that use radio to amplify their advertising are 49% more likely to get noticed. See radio differently. At radiocentre.org.
Hi, I'm Andrew from New Zealand and Australia travel specialist, Travel Essence. For a tailor-made holiday unlike any other, find your way to us. Our local knowledge saves you time and money, and our experience is your guarantee of quality. We are also members of ABTA and ETOL. Amazing journeys down under start at travelessence.co.uk.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Text 84850.
Time is 12:34. Well, as we reported in the last hour, we have just before Christmas got a little festive U-turn from the government. All farmers will be spared the inheritance tax after a climb down by ministers. The threshold for 100% relief has been more than doubled. This is the Department for the Environment has just announced. It was supposed to be 1 million, but it's now going to be at 2.5 million. The government said the revised threshold would allow spouses or civil partners on farms to pass up to 5 million in qualifying agricultural or business assets between them before paying tax. Emma Reynolds, the Environment Secretary, saying, "We've listened closely to farmers across the country and we're making changes today to protect more ordinary family farms." Let's talk now to Tom Bradshaw, President of the National Farmers Union, of course. Thanks so much for joining us, Tom. You must be very pleased about this. Are you claiming this is a victory?
But there must be a massive sense of relief across the farming industry today. There'll be many farmers, particularly the elderly generation, that were so concerned about their future that they're going to be able to sleep more easily this Christmas because of the change which has been made by the government. So it's something that we really welcome. It's taken 14 months of long, hard campaigning to get to this stage where they've recognised the personal toll was something that could not be lived with. But we really do welcome the fact that at the 11th hour the change has been made and that the Prime Minister and the Chancellor have listened to all the proposals that have been coming in from across the country.
Are you satisfied now with the proposals as is?
That we are. I mean, it's a significant change. We have different positions around HyHT. We don't believe it should be there at all. But the proposal that was there of £1 million was trapping the vast majority of working family farms absolutely in the eye of that storm. Raising the threshold in the way they have is going to mitigate the impacts for the vast majority, but it will reduce the tax burden for everybody. So we believe it's more manageable where it's set now. It doesn't mean that we won't be looking for others to change it as we get towards future elections, but the changes announced today really do mitigate the worst of the impacts for the vast majority. And we welcome the fact that the government have listened and been willing to make a very difficult change.
Presumably, the actual tax now yield as a result of this changes will be pretty nugatory.
I haven't worked through the calculations on how much tax revenue is going to be raised.
What's the point of it? I mean, presumably it's going to be. It wasn't a huge amount of money to begin with.
I mean, it was supposedly 550 million to begin with, I think. I mean, who knows what it's going to be with this change. But the reality is for us, it was about the working family farm. It was about our members that were caught in the eye of this storm. There's still the principle of taxing a business asset that's producing the country's food, which is one that we will disagree about. But recognition that they weren't protecting the family farm and that the threshold was set too low is something that, as I say, will give relief to many farms right the way across the United Kingdom.
Tom, you said something just now, which you just said that you know, as a result of this, the tax burden will be lower for everybody. Well, it won't be in one sense, which is that the money that would have been raised by it will now have to be raised elsewhere, potentially by tax rises on other parts of the population. I know that your cause does get a lot of sympathy, but I get people, when we talked about it yesterday, I had people messaging in. I can see people doing it now saying, why should farmers be treated differently from everybody else?
Farmers aren't treated differently. All businesses, all family business will benefit from the changes today. So anybody that will qualify for APR or BPR, which clearly farmers are a critical part of, but all family business will benefit from these changes. And family business is the bedrock of entrepreneurialism in this country. If we want to drive economic growth, we need entrepreneurs to invest. We need people to take risks and to be willing to, or able to build their capital base. Otherwise, what's the point in taking the risks? So I think this unlocks the potential to deliver the economic growth that everybody in this country needs. And so I recognise that there is a reduced tax take. There was a £20 billion plus headroom, I think, that the Chancellor had in the last budget. This was a rounding error within the public tax take, the amount of money that was going to be raised from the inheritance tax proposal. So I don't see it as being significant from that perspective. But I know that for our members that were caught in the eye of this storm, it really is significant. So I think the balance the government have struck today is one that the vast majority of farmers will be welcoming, and that it will really mitigate those impacts.
But why should agricultural land be passed on with little or no inheritance tax? That's not like other assets, homes or financial investments. Why should agricultural land be exempted?
So all business assets are treated the same way. All family business assets are treated the same way. And actually, if you get up into big corporations, then the impacts are far, far lower anyway. There was actually an anomaly here that family businesses were going to be treated in a way that big corporations weren't, that charities weren't, because they will never pay inheritance tax. So this is a much more reasonable proposal, which is...
Well, no, companies aren't going to pay inheritance tax. Big companies aren't going to pay inheritance tax, but they might pay the shareholders or the people who invested in them will pay inheritance tax on the income that they derive from those companies, from their shares and so on.
But it doesn't end the business. When one shareholder dies, it doesn't risk ending the future of that business. And this was what with the threat that was facing all family businesses, was that if the wrong member died in the family, died in the wrong order, it risked the very future of that family farm or the family business. We've been saying the land is the food producing asset. If we were making significant returns from producing the country's food and we were making that 10, 12, 15% return on capital, it's a different conversation. But we're only making a 0.5% to 1% return on the asset. There isn't the income generated to pay the inheritance tax. And so treating working assets, business assets, as though they were personal assets is where the policy was so wrong. So we believe that the proposal the government have come to here is one which better reflects the fact that working family farms producing this country's food aren't generating the income required to pay the inheritance tax that you would if, say, you inherit a house where you actually have something to sell.
So, do you think as a result of this, we spoke yesterday about whether the government understands farmers and understands people who work in agriculture and so on, as a result of this, would you be willing to say now that they do understand you and they've listened?
No, I'd say that this is a really good start as we go into 2026, but we've got 70 million people living on an island at a time of huge geopolitical volatility. We need to make sure that we have a plan for how those 70 million people are going to be fed. That requires an agricultural industry that is confident for the future, that can invest in the infrastructure on farms that's needed to produce the country's food. And the government have got a long way to go with the planning system, with trade policy, to make sure that that confidence really is there to invest for the future. But this is a great start as we go into 2026. And I look forward to working with the government to make sure that we have that plan for how we're going to produce the food for the country for the next decade.
I just wonder, with all respect, Tom, why you think it is that, say, someone who owns millions of pounds worth of agricultural land shouldn't be paying inheritance tax, when you might get someone who owns a £400,000 house and they don't have a spouse, and they'll pay inheritance tax on their small home. Why on earth should that be fair?
They won't actually pay inheritance tax on their home, no. It will be their next generation
that pay inheritance tax. Well, fine. Well, all right, but someone who might inherit £5 million of agricultural land.
They would have something to sell.
You could sell the land.
Yes, so what we said to the government, our initial proposal was a clawback proposal, so that if the asset was sold, so if we liquidate the land value into cash, we'll pay the tax at that point. The government didn't like that suggestion, but we very much came up with that suggestion. So if you continue producing the country's food, if the paper asset never turns into a cash asset, then you wouldn't be taxed. But if you turn that paper asset into a cash asset, then you would be taxed at that point. So we have recognised different solutions right the way through. We've been trying to provide the government with alternatives. We've been working very closely with backbench MPs. But I think it is very different. If you have an asset to sell, as in inheriting a house, then it's very different to having a business asset, whether that's for agricultural land or whether it's producing widgets. If you've got a business asset, taxing that business asset as though it's personal wealth is where the problem with this policy lies.
Tom Bradshaw there, president of the National Farmers Union, who has undoubtedly, with his members, scored a victory, I suppose some Labour MPs, particularly in rural constituencies, and there are quite a few of those these days, will be thinking, well, what was the point of all that? Because basically they've burned through a load of goodwill and a load of political capital, particularly in those constituencies, which is unlikely to be recovered despite the U-turn, and all for what? Yet another minor political disaster is too strong a word, certainly mistake, which has to be laid at the door of the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, who I think it's fair to say, in one way or another, has had a very bad year. A few of your texts on this now, on the question about fertility as well. Miriam says, Lewis, dating culture, 1, 2, cost, 3, state of the world. Happy holidays. Well, that was pithy, Miriam. To be fair, I never quite get the state of the world stuff, because, I mean, you know, there were lots of people having kids in the 1950s, when everybody thought, in the early 1960s, when everyone thought the world was on the verge of nuclear war. Kevin says, Lewis, 50 to 60% of global countries have not reached the birth replacement rate for about 40 years. Europe and Southeast Asia have the biggest problem. Immigration is an asset, not a problem that politicians have been pushing for decades. I mean, Kevin, you are right. We can easily imagine a world where population, particularly the hunt for young people, becomes treated like a scarce resource. And you're already seeing that a little bit with the digital nomad schemes in different parts of the world, trying to encourage young people to come, set up businesses, do what they need to do, because younger people, particularly educated younger people, are becoming rarer in the grand scheme of things. And Vela says, for years, women weren't allowed to own their own homes, have credit cards, had no ability to be independent. Now we do, and we're choosing not to have children for many reasons, including the cost of raising them. Men are also falling far below the standards that women want and deserve, and therefore have less need of them. Well, thanks a bunch, Vela. The time's 12:45.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Asma Mir.
Another U-turn from Keir Starmer. New inheritance tax rules will now affect farms worth over £2.5 million, not £1 million. Is that common sense, or someone who keeps on getting it wrong?
Asma Mir at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
This Christmas Eve, the £50 million Lotto jackpot must be won.
Must be won.
Must be won.
Must be won.
Yes, the £50 million Lotto jackpot must be won on Christmas Eve.
There's magic in the air, so get your ticket today. Lotto from the National Lottery. It could be you. Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Thanks for the key deliverables, David. Now, who'd like to...
Stay out all night! Yoo-hoo!
That's brilliant. So, OK, sales targets. Are we hitting...
The dance floor!
There's more than one you, and with Specsavers 2-for-1, you can choose glasses for at least two yous. From £70 with standard single-vision lenses.
Nice moves, David!
Book an appointment at specsavers.co.uk. Conditions apply.
When you're smiling...
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Thanks for a lovely evening. Would you like to come in for a coffee?
Yeah, okay. That'd be lovely.
Oh, gosh, sorry. I didn't mean... I just wanted you to see my new Wix kitchen. It's just been installed.
At Wix, our experts will support you every step of the way, from a free kitchen design service through to a professional installation. Plus, right now, find big savings in the Wix kitchen sale. Book a free design appointment and feel as proud as a peacock with Wix. Terms apply.
New year, new you. Maybe. New year, new car, definitely. Upgrade your year with a new Vauxhall Fonterra Electric or any car from our award-winning range. With 0% APR over 4 years with a minimum 20% deposit and £1,000 off on top of all other offers. That's a resolution worth sticking to. Search Vauxhall today. £1,000 saving on new car orders until the January 2026. Personal contract purchase, 20% deposit, 18 plus. Subject to status and availability. T's and C's, Stellantis Financial Services.
A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, tap up on island fuel. R, rest every 2 hours too. I, inspect tire pressure and tread. P, prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. A safe trip begins with
Think. Do the 4 trip checks before every long journey. National Highways.
Leading Britain's conversation. LBC with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 12:48. We're going to close the show with this conversation about why the fertility rate is declining. Also get an update on those Epstein files. Latest ones have just been released, 11,000. It looks like there could be some embarrassing things in there for President Trump. First, let's talk to Nikita, who is in Stourbridge, who has something to say about this. Nikita, good afternoon.
Hi, Lewis. I think one of the issues, and I know there's going to be lots of eye rolls at this, is a millennial issue. So, you know, if you think it takes two people now, two full-time incomes to afford a home, the grandparents aren't around either.
That's a huge change, Nikita, which I haven't even mentioned. That's a huge change. You go back not so far long ago and, you know, grandparents being around and available, that was a huge help.
Yeah, like we've had such a degradation of the village. So either grandparents are aging out, you know, they've got health issues, they can't help out, or they're still working, or they're far away because, you know, due to university or whatever, people have migrated around the country. You just don't have that same type of familial support. So that then puts extra pressure on the household, because the cost of childcare is really high. You've got the time issue, you know, up with the kids in the night time, then going to work full time. You're kind of expected to have a 1950s level of housekeeping.
Yes.
And then also work full time or part time, whatever it is, in order to make things meet.
What do you make of the argument? And you do hear this. I've heard this from Nikita from some people, which is to say, look, they recognise many of the things that you've just said, but they're warning women that they need to think about this now in particular, because if they don't, they'll regret it later on.
I get that. I mean, I have struggled with fertility issues myself. I'm 35. I've got a two-year-old. But the way that the world is set up, or the way that the society is set up at the moment, it's pushing women into having kids later and later, because without getting those degrees and experience in the workplace, you're not going to get the income in order to have a good standard of living. And then even when you do, you know, the tax brackets aren't necessarily moving with inflation. Yes. So I'm a teacher. I'm currently working part-time. If I worked full-time, I would be pushed into the 40% tax bracket. And then I've got my student loan repayments on the back of that increasing because of the wage increase. It's just not affordable. I would love to have more than one kid, but...
What do you think would make the biggest difference, Nikki? Because it seems to be saying with you that it really is structural and economic. You'd like to have more, but you're not able to. So what would you think would be the... Is there something the government could do which would enable you to have another one?
I think there needs to be better support from the government, more incentives. So I'm over the moon that they've changed the childcare to 30 hours from 9 months. That is very, very helpful. But it's still... a pretty high cost, you know. Then you've got the additional cost of after school wraparound care and all that kind of stuff, which makes it difficult.
And of course, there's the and you know, some people might say this is a nice problem to have, whatever. But like, you know, there is the fabled drop off rate now, the cliff edge that if you have one person earn over 100,000 a year, like a pound. More, not a household. So you could have two people who earn 90,000 each, and this wouldn't happen. But if you have one person who earns more than 100,000, a pound more, then basically your effective tax rate goes up to about 70% for the next 25 grand because you lose your entitlement to the free childcare. So, it's not easy.
Where is the incentive for people to have children and to earn more? It kind of ties in with what you were talking about earlier about. You know, middle class and what have you. At least they have the option.
Freedom.
There is the confidence of, well, there is money in the family, perhaps, you know, we can support here and there. We just don't have that.
Nikita in Stourbridge, so grateful to you. And like, I do think Nikita hits the nail on the head, which is that, look, if we're in a situation where the economic system is at least in part producing a situation where families or couples who would like to have kids aren't able to do so for economic reasons, and that is not just happening at the margins, it's sort of embedded in society. Yes, some of it will be about making different choices and wanting to have a different sort of life, fair enough, but if the mainstay or a large portion of it is about that, something is clearly going wrong. I do also see a lot of people taking issue with that text that I read out before the break, saying that women's problems are a sort of lack of quality of men. A lot of people not enjoying that, including this person, I think, has not left their name, who says, historically, I would like to object to that. Women have never had it better with men. That is a fact. There's still work to be done with men, but to compare the contemporary man to historical men and say the pick is worse today is diabolical. This is actually a first world problem, despite the standard of men being better compared to many places globally. So there you go. The rejoinder to that. Let's just go back to that news, that breaking news we had in the last hour or so. Of 11,000 new documents related to Jeffrey Epstein being released by the Department of Justice. And obviously, journalists around the world will have been combing through these over the course of the last hour or two to give a sense of what might be in them, or some of the things that might be in them. We might only look to the US Department of Justice putting out a tweet saying that's urging caution that some of the documents reference the US President Donald Trump without specifying which ones. They've tweeted, some of these documents contain untrue and sensationalist claims made against President Trump that were submitted to the FBI right before the 2020 election. To be clear, the claims are unfounded and false. Let's turn now to Scott Lucas, Professor of American Politics, University College, Dublin. Scott, Professor, I should say, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. Obviously, people combing through these around the world. Do we have much sense of what is in them and what might be different to the caches that we've had before?
Yeah, we do. I think the first thing is, and this is not false, it's very true, is that there are documents that establish that Donald Trump was traveled at least 8 times on Jeffrey Epstein's airplane in the 1990s, that on one occasion he and Epstein were the only passengers, along with an unnamed 20-year-old woman, and that on other occasions he was on the plane with at least two, either girls or women, who could be potential witnesses in the case that was eventually brought against Jeffrey Epstein's associate, Ghislaine Maxwell. Now, I hasten to add, none of that proves that Trump was involved in any criminal activity, but it does put him very, very close to Jeffrey Epstein, which we sort of knew before, but it just confirms it. But if I could give you an even bigger story.
Please.
That I think people haven't. these documents, or at least the Justice Department, actually dropped the documents last night. And then after a few hours, they pulled them. So there were a couple of news outlets that downloaded the documents before they were pulled. And here's what's interesting. Amongst the documents that were out and then retracted is that after Jeffrey Epstein died in August 2019, prosecutors produced a 7-page memorandum on co-conspirators who might be charged. They followed that up with an 86-page update in December of 2019. They had a 13-page memorandum of corporate prosecutions they might pursue and a 26-page memorandum on a specific target. Now, the documents that were out for a few hours just simply referred to these memoranda. They weren't the actual memoranda in full. Mm. But now those references have been pulled. Clearly, we have documents that are out there from prosecutors that name people who may have been involved with Epstein in the crimes, possible co-conspirators that we have yet to see. Now, are they still being withheld? Are they still being reviewed to be redacted? But it's a very, very big clue. And it does back up the claim of Representative Thomas Massie, the Republican who's pushed for the full release, that there are at least 20 men who are at least named in these documents who could be, and I stress could be, involved in criminal activity alongside Jeffrey Epstein.
So it seems, therefore, Professor, that obviously people will still be going through these documents and doubtless other things will emerge throughout the course of the afternoon, morning US time. But it would seem, given what you've just said, that it is likely that even this latest cache of documents, despite the fact that this is the largest yet of over 10 gigabytes and 11,000 different documents, is likely to actually whet the appetite further of those who want to see documents which still have not been published because they may allude to the idea of a greater potential conspiracy.
Yeah, this is only the start. We go into the new year either getting further documents that finally begin to give transparency and accountability to the victims of Jeffrey Epstein and these other men, or we witness the Trump camp trying to still pull back and being selective in what they release because they might be protecting somebody.
And what is the justification at this point for any of the documents to still be being released, if you see what I mean, on the basis of my understanding, at least, of the, and you tell me if I'm wrong about this, but my understanding of the act passed by the Congress was clear that all of the documents must be released. And the Department of Justice appeared, and that was supposed to take place by last Friday. And yet here we are still with different documents being released and some being withheld and withdrawn and published again.
Yeah, there was a 30-day deadline that expired last Friday and all documents were supposed to come out. And there's a 15-day period after that to explain any redactions. Having worked with government documents in other cases, sensitive government documents for many, many years, I can understand that if you're talking about hundreds of thousands of pages of documents, that they may not have been able to meet the deadline. But I think there are two issues that are quite clear. The first is that there were certain documents that were not released that are central in terms of this case. They have not released the 60-count indictment against Epstein from 2019. They have not released the evidence, which is the basis for that. And they have not released, or they completely redacted, a 119-page document related to a grand jury investigation. But the second reason why I think they aren't being full and forthcoming is, at the very least, when government documents are redacted, you provide explanations for the redactions. It may be to protect victims, witnesses. It may be for security reasons, but you provide explanations. They have not done so in this case, and they have not provided context. Instead, you might remember that with the first release, what they did is they tried to distract the media by putting out celebrity photos, and they tried repeatedly to point people towards Bill Clinton. And on two occasions, they lied about the photographs of Clinton, trying to falsely indicate that he was involved in criminal activity.
Professor Lucas, Professor Scott Lucas there, Professor of American Politics at University College Dublin. That is doubtless a story which will continue to evolve over the course of the afternoon, and we'll bring you all the latest developments here, of course, on LBC. I'm done for the day. If you missed any of today's show, you can, of course, listen back for free on our free Global Player app, new LBC app, where you can, of course, listen as well to a range of podcasts, including, it's quite good, I hear, the news agents. Weekend's podcast. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Tom Swarbrick, but now standing in for Sheila Fogarty, it's Asma Mir.
Lewis, thank you very much. Some good news, early Christmas present perhaps for farmers and family businesses. The government has changed their mind on inheritance tax for farmers and family businesses. The threshold at which they'll pay inheritance tax has gone from 1 million up to 2.5 million. It's another U-turn from the government. But should they have U-turned? Are farmers a special case? Or should they pay inheritance tax like the rest of us? Are they a special case? Or do you think that they are being treated differently? 0345 60 60 973.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock. The government has backed down on its changes to inheritance tax for farmers following months of protest. The relief threshold has been increased from £1 million to £2.5 million, which means spouses can now pass on up to £5 million in assets tax-free. The Environment Secretary says ministers back businesses that are the backbone of Britain's rural communities. President of the National Farmers Union, Tom Bradshaw, has told LBC it's a huge relief.
The proposal that was there of £1 million was trapping the vast majority of working family farms absolutely in the eye of that storm. It doesn't mean that we won't be looking for others to change it as we get towards future elections, but the changes announced today really do mitigate the worst of the impacts for the vast majority. And we welcome the fact that the government have listened and been willing to make a very difficult change.
A man's been remanded into custody after being charged with 56 offences against his ex-wife. Philip Young, who's 49 and originally from Swindon, is accused of drugging and raping Joanne Young, who's waived her anonymity. LBC's reporter Thea Rickard has more from Swindon Magistrates Court.
Philip Young is among six men due to appear in court today, charged with offences against Ms. Young between 2010 and 2023. We're expecting those other five men to appear here at Swindon Magistrates Court this afternoon. 49-year-old Philip Young was told to attend Swindon Crown Court on January the 23rd next year.
The US Department of Justice says some newly released documents on Jeffrey Epstein contain untrue and sensationalist claims about Donald Trump. An email shows the US president was listed as a passenger on Epstein's private jet on eight flights between 1993 and 1996. On one flight, the only passengers were Trump, Epstein and a 20-year-old whose name is redacted. Climate activist Greta Thunberg has been arrested at a protest in support of Palestine Action protesters on hunger strike in prison. Police say the 22-year-old was detained over a placard in support of the proscribed organisation. And police leaders will reportedly pressure the Home Secretary to scrap non-crime hate incidents in the new year. Officers were warned recording them undermines freedom of speech and diverts officers away from fighting crime. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 6 points at 98.72. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.14. LBC weather generally cloudy this afternoon with a few spots of light rain, brief bright spells in the west, patchy rain moving across the north, a high of 10 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
There's always a lot going on. I'm on site getting the job done, running the business too, payments, invoices, admin, all on me. But now with Tap to Pay, I can take payments there and then, and Sage sorts the admin afterwards. Everything's sorted in the background, so I don't spend hours doing it later. Magic.
Sage Copilot is built with over 40 years of experience, helping British businesses like Mike at Residual Electrical Contractors. That's more than artificial intelligence. That's authentic intelligence. Search Sage Copilot to learn more. T's and C's apply.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Asma Mir.
Welcome to the programme. It is 5 minutes past one. This is Asma Mir sitting in for Sheila Fogarty. In the first hour, we're going to talk about a U-turn by the government. This is a press release that was issued by DEFRA, the government department, of course, with responsibility for agricultural issues, which said that the very controversial measure that was unveiled in the 2024 budget that meant that farmers would face paying inheritance tax at a 20% rate on agricultural property and land worth over £1 million, that was going to happen in April. That 1 million mark has been moved up. It's moved up to 2.5 million, which is a huge move, actually. And you'll remember all the protests that there were, the tractors, in central London, various, kind of well-known people taking on this cause and talking about how farmers were going to be affected by this huge change that's coming in April. So this is, for farmers and for family businesses, a victory, some respite, they will say, of course, and we'll hear from them soon, that they would like this change to be possibly completely reversed. But I suppose what I want to ask you is, do you think it's fair? Now, clearly, when you as a group are targeted by a change in a budget, you feel very much penalised and you feel it's unfair, and therefore you will campaign to get that changed. And if this is something that you feel doesn't affect you, you perhaps might not feel the same way. We're talking about a 20% rate on agricultural property and land worth more than £1 million. Now, inheritance tax for people like you and me is slightly different. It's property and assets over £325,000. It's a bit complicated. But anyway, the rate for non-farming people is 40%. The rate for farmers is 20%. So I suppose what I'm asking you is it fair? Is it right to raise the threshold, or should farms and family businesses pay the same as everyone else? I should say, before everyone starts shouting, that not everyone pays inheritance tax. Only 1 in 20 estates in the UK pay inheritance tax. But people still do. And it is a very unpopular tax across the board. So is it fair that farmers get special treatment, or is it right? They feed us, after all. 0345 606 0973. Let's speak to Natasha Clark, who's LBC's political editor. Afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Asma. Yes, a huge Christmas present, isn't it, for the farmers today?
Well, is it a bit of a surprise, though? Because I think I'm right in saying, Natasha, that just a couple of weeks ago, Keir Starmer was asked about this policy and said that he thought that this was the correct thing to do. He said that they were sensible reforms.
Yeah, that's right. He was asked about this at the liaison committee just a couple of weeks ago, where he was sort of confronted with some MPs saying, well, are you aware that some farmers are considering taking their lives over this very, very controversial policy, which, as you say, is going to change the inheritance tax on farms? And the Tories have dubbed it a family farm tax. And you're right, this is a big climb down from the government today. And Keir Starmer and his government have been involved at the very highest level, I'm told, at this decision. The PM was involved, the Chancellor was involved, the Environment Secretary, of course, Emma Reynolds, who we've been hearing from today, of course, was involved as well in making this decision to basically really water down these reforms. And as you say, hundreds of farmers staging such noisy protests for more than a year now. So this is going to kick in April. This really is the last moment that the government could have done this U-turn, because they are bringing forward